Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, April 4th, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, call the number is 701-801-1220, participant code 118-676-260. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions into questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. That's questions, plural, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 through 13. Uh-oh. Yeah?
Well, this is first, Brent.
How you doing, Brent? Hang on 1 minute.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 1 through 13. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity, I become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity wanteth not itself. Is not puffed up, doeth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail, whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. But we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, and charity. These three, but the greatest of these is charity. Okay, that was God's word, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 1 through 13. Okay, we just got a few things to share tonight. We have nothing of any length that we're going to be getting involved with, and then Brent will be coming in speaking for a while, and then we'll go into an open forums. We're working on a PowerPoint video to empower the sheriff. It's pretty much close to being written now. Hopefully tomorrow we'll start working on the PowerPoint video itself. Get it together, get it up online. We'll put it on the front page of our website or page for sheriffs. And also we have a website which goes to the same page on our website, which is powerofthecountysheriff.org or com. I think we got both, com and org. But anyway, powerofthecountysheriff.org. And it will give the information. We've been asked often, you know, by what authority do we act, or, you know, what is the power of the sheriff, you know, what is the positioning? And we have written some papers on these things, but we're going to really do something that really, really focuses in on the authority of the sheriff, the necessity of the sheriff, and how common law cannot be without a sheriff. You need a constitutional officer and protector of our Constitution. And the conclusion is that the county sheriff is one of our, we the people's, unalienable rights. We have a right to have an individual who is the chief executive of the county to make sure that due process, to make sure that abuses from those who are elected and exercising their authorities, who do not go beyond their authority acting under color of law. And that is the purpose of the sheriff, to prevent these things. Nobody can remove any property from anyone except the sheriff, and of course only after due process has been executed. And so it is the duty of the sheriff, whenever any kind of instrument is being executed upon someone, any kind of a warrant to seize a person or an item, or to execute any kind of a thing on the person, that the sheriff is to be notified and to make sure that due process has been given to that individual. The sheriff is also responsible to make sure due process has been executed in a court of law for anyone that is delivered to him in the prison, to the county jail. So this is the type of thing we're going to be covering and making sure that the sheriff understands. And we'll just go from there. We'll see how that comes up. And we're hoping to have that done maybe Wednesday or Thursday, sometime this week. We will be meeting a meeting for district coordinators. Will be Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'll be there for a short period of time in the beginning speaking and then pass it over to whoever's running it on Wednesday. But generally, just to go through this, where we're at with this PowerPoint. We also will have a copy of this PowerPoint in PDF, and that is one of the things we're going to be looking to work with all of the district leaders, who will be working with all the people within their state to make contact with sheriff through the paper itself. We'll have them either mail, or if people want to go visit the sheriff, and give a copy of this to the sheriff and let them know where online they can find the PowerPoint copy of the same. So that'll be the next project we're going to start working on with all of the district coordinators. The district coordinators, again, are organizing the states and bringing the people together for this purpose, for communications, and preparing, of course, for taking control of the courts once we can do that. Let's see. We also have made contact with an individual, Matthew. I don't have his last name, but he has a lot of information concerning the Committee of Safety. We are involved with the Committee of Safety out in Oregon as an advisor. I know Gerard's not available tonight. Maybe he'll be on before the call is over and he can talk some more in depth, because he's more understanding of what's going on there with the Committee of Safety out in Oregon than I am. But we're working with lots of different people, and we mentioned some things last week, and hopefully soon we'll be able to reveal a lot of the things we are doing, but right now we're not going to get into too many details. But one of the things we are working with is the Committee of Safety. And that Committee of Safety, we're looking into, again, this individual, Matthew, who understands the process of putting together a Committee of Safety. And the leadership here at National Liberty Alliance has come to realize that this is a very important program that we, the people, can execute in our own communities. And it'll assist us in many ways. It'll assist the people to come together and look at the things and the problems from the grassroots level, and also and to formulate possible solutions for that. And there are different powers and authorities that they can execute to some degree, which, again, we're not going to get into detail tonight on it, but we'll be looking at these things in the future, and hopefully building these committees of safeties across America. The idea, of course, is to get this going in every town in America. There's quite a few towns and villages and cities and so on in America. Well, we'll just say towns and cities in America. We'll start gathering people on a county level where people are interested to start working on this project within their own communities. And as they develop enough people within each one of the particular towns, they break away into their own committee for the sole purpose of communicating to the people the concerns, and the people of the town can come to talk about their concerns and so on. So anyway, we'll be starting, we're going to have our first meeting, and I'm not sure when it's going, how often it's going to happen or when it's going to happen, but we will be putting a lot of educational materials up on our website. We'll create a page. We'll get a committee chairman. I believe Matthew will be that committee chairman. He'll be looking for partners, I'm sure, to assist him, to train and teach people these things. This will also help grow our membership, get people involved. A lot of people who come into National Liberty Alliance, usually because they've got a little bit of a experience in the court and they're realizing the necessities of the work that we're doing here. But many people in the Liberty Movement, they're kind of aware of us, but they feel maybe we're too far above their normal lines of thinking, maybe. Law frightens people away and so on. Well, the Committees of Safeties is something that we can put out there that is a very quick, easy sell to the liberty-minded people. People will see the advantage of this, and they're already, you know, all these liberty groups are out there already in, you know, have put themselves together and organized and trying to do different things, and we're just going to give them this tool. And that's exactly what it is. It's a tool. We will give the people. It will be up to the people within their counties to look into whatever they think they need to look into, discuss it, and see what kind of solutions can be discovered. And we'll be assisting them in some of these solutions from the perspective of the judiciary, what's going on in the courts. So, again, we're going to have our first meeting this Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll send out an email on this. Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. It may have gone out on our last email for updates. I'm not sure whether we got that in there or not. But anyway, we'll send out an email. So again, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will be having the meeting in this. Well, what we're going to do, we also spoke about potentially going back to the other format that we had before. A lot of us don't feel very comfortable with what we have here with this particular format here on what's this called, Start Meeting. So I think we're going to be going back to Free Conference Call. I think it was HD, Free Conference Call HD, I think it was called. Anyway, we'll put that, that's what it was?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we will put that information. I'm going to change the page up on our website tomorrow. I'll get up there and change the page, go back to original numbers or phone numbers. We'll put that information, and we'll send an email out on that. And our next meeting on Saturday will be in that room. Also, our meeting on Wednesday will be in that room. And we were having some problems there, so if these two meetings go well, we're going to stay in that room and see how things go. If not, we'll be forced back here by next Monday, but we're planning not to be here, but on to the other one. And again, we'll send emails out explaining that, given the details. An additional email other than our weekly email that I think goes out on Friday or Saturday. Again, the Committee of Safety will be meeting on Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Meeting organizing our districts and then for our state, federal district meeting is going to be Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, both back into the old HD room. And then we'll see where we go from there. I know there's a lot more to share on the Committee of Safeties, but we're not going to get into detail. We'll save that for Thursday. I'm going to speak probably on Saturday for the first 15 minutes or so. I'm not sure how long, but just to get things going and to build a framework of what it is we're trying to do and how it can assist the people, we the people, and assist National Liberty Alliance growth and movement into the courts. We did send out, we announced this last week, the letter to the sheriffs. We're at that point now. We need to start communicating with them, and again, that's what we're going to be using the committee of, not the committee of safety, the district leadership. We're going to move the district leadership will be involved with also the committee of safety. We'll put it underneath that wing, so to speak. We broke up the United States into 90 parts, 90 different federal districts, with the exception of the four territories, which is 94, so it's going to be 90. And we will work an oversight. They will become sort of an oversight committee of that and assist people, and we'll work that together where the Committee of Safety probably will be working maybe at the same meeting when necessary, with the organization going forward with the district leadership. So not sure exactly how that's going to work out. I don't want to overburden people with too many meetings, so maybe we can consolidate these things. What we may do is do questions and answers and bring them onto the Monday night call if someone has a particular question or concerning that committee of safety. Maybe if Matthew could make it to the Monday night meetings, he could be here, and he can field those particular questions. But we'll see where we go and how this develops, and we'll organize it accordingly. Before we move forward to Brent, I don't know, is there any questions out there? I think I saw something in the email, but I haven't been through my email. I got a lot of emails this past week. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, we got some good questions.
Uh-oh, go ahead.
Yeah, this is a hot one. Somebody had directed somebody to the NLA website, and they went and looked at the sheriff's document as requested and made a comment back to the person who referred them as common law documents deriving authority and power from the Bible is not accurate. As English common law derives from the legal system left behind by the Roman Empire when it withdrew from England. Can you please respond with an answer?
Yeah, well, lawyers would have us to believe that common law is a collection of whatever goes on in the courts and decisions of judges collectively, and that's common law, it's common to us, and so on. But that's not true. Common law is natural law, synonymous. It is courts of justice, and justice is synonymous with virtue, and that brings us back to the law of God. The first people to live under common law, ultimately, that we could record it, of course, was Israel in 1440 B.C., I believe it was. Well, 1400 B.C. That's the first known. And, of course, we have unalienable rights. That is the key to where our law comes from. And a matter of fact, we did do a paper, and I was going to release it and talk about it tonight, but I think we'll wait till next week and release it with the sheriff information because we're going to connect that with the sheriff. But we did a paper laying out, tracing the history of law and where it comes from. And there's only two laws, and Benjamin Franklin mentions this also. He says either we will be ruled by God or we will be ruled by tyrants. He gave us no other choices. And when you go back into history looking to follow out law, you discover law comes really from God. It's from the creation. That's where the law pretty much came forward. But it was established through Moses up on the mountain back at about 1400 B.C. And Israel lived under 400 years under the rule of the law of God for 400 years and has had great success. Thomas Jefferson called that time period as a happy time, a time period of harmony. And remember, Benjamin Franklin was the founder of our government. He was the one that researched through history and structured together the government we have, which is built upon upon Israel, how Israel was constructed and went forward with their government, and they were ruled by families and tens and hundreds and thousands and so on. We fall under that. The law that came in through Rome, ultimately, I believe, and when Brent comes on, he may correct this. Matter of fact, we'll ask him to speak on this for a couple of minutes before he takes on his subject matter. But I believe the law of Rome came originally from Babylon. That's where the law of man first seems to have originated in history that we know of, and it moved throughout the world. And I'm sure it changed in different ways, of course. Particularly, it came to Rome, but it came through, I think, the process for an individual named Justinian, who pulled together all of this information on Babylonian law, and I believe that was before Rome, and then Rome built upon that. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure that was the case. And then Rome built upon that. We have what's called Roman law, which is also civil law. And of course, that found its way into England, and there was the war between the two laws, the civil law versus the natural law. And so we only have two choices. We either have a law that is created by men, and the purpose of that law ultimately is to bring obedience to the state, to be subservient to the state, or are we going to live under the law, natural law, which is the creator of the universe, law of God? And, of course, then we will be subservient to our creator. And those are the only two options. Search out history, and that's what you will find. Again, we did a chart on this, and we will release that next week. We'll talk about it and release that chart and post it, and maybe we'll briefly go through it. And again, when I pass things over to Brent, I'm sure he can comment on this for a few minutes and give a more accurate and maybe a little more information than I did. Okay, so, you know, that it's a big error thinking that we get our lore from Rome or Roman Empire as far as being common law. Nothing could be further from the truth on that. But again, I will say, I've talked to many lawyers who think that common law is a collection of court decisions and different things as far as within our law here in America and even in England. But it's more than that. Any other questions?
Yes, John. We need to make a correction here. It was my understanding that Matthew Formation had a conflict for an 11 o'clock meeting with us, and it was set then for 12, and I just got a Skype from Robert and said he sent out an email today announcing it for 12 noon.
Okay, so it would be 12 o'clock then.
Right.
12 o'clock Eastern's time is good.
Right.
Great. Okay, that's good. We'll move that then. That's, we'll make that correction. It'll be 12 noon time, Eastern Standard Time,
right.
In the old room. Again, we'll put that information on the Monday night call room. We'll put that information up. Is there any other questions?
Yes. Gary? Yeah, we have another question. Is there any case law that authorizes the sheriff to summon the jury?
Is there any case law? Well, there's history. I'm not sure about case law particularly, but there's plenty of history. Again, I know Brent may want to comment on this also. And that's the purpose of our paper. I'm not going to get too deep into it tonight, but we're going to talk about this in great detail. We put together a paper, which, again, as I mentioned, is going to be a video, a PowerPoint video, and a PDF alongside of it. So the sheriff or anybody that wants information on this will have a PDF hard copy to be able to take with them, read, and follow along with the PowerPoint if they want. Because we need to get this information out. And we're going to make the case clear that common law and America cannot be an America without a constitutional officer. And just think about this. Law of men is controlled by men. Law of God is controlled by God. We have many different police departments throughout the nation. Okay, we have village police, we have town police, city police, county police, we have state police, we have the federal FBI, and we have all these different police departments. Every single one of them answers to an elected official. Okay, that's their source of authority. Whether they take an oath or not, they still trace the authority that they're operating by to an individual. And if that individual is not happy, that has the control of the ability to hire and fire, so to speak, a mayor or a councilman of a town or something of that nature, the state police, for instance, answers to the governor. New York City police answers to the mayor. Okay, so these answer to individuals. And if you upset these people and they want to get rid of the head honcho, the chief, the commissioner, or whatever the name of that chief individual might be, or whatever it is that they really want to push or enforce, their will is done. And that's the dangers and the problems of a police force controlled by political individuals. The sheriff is not so. He's the only individual elected by the people. The sheriff is the only individual that can gather together and create a posse. He can deputize anyone. He can call together an entire community and pull forward, posse comitatus. Okay, to protect the county or to go out and search for something or whatever the case may be. But he answers to the people, and he's governed and has a duty to obey the Constitution. There's no way you're going to get a police officer or a peace officer or whatever you want to call him to obey the Constitution if his boss is saying, nope, this is what you're going to do. And I'll give you an example of that. In New York, there's a lot of sheriffs that are saying they're not going to take guns away from people. because they're working very difficult, very hard on this. And a lot of sheriffs are saying, look, we're drawing a line there. We're not going out to collect guns. So what are they trying to do in New York? They're trying to take away the control of the permits for guns here in New York and pass it over to the state police. Now, I have heard a while back that they're already in that motion of doing those things here in New York to take it away from the sheriff. It hasn't happened yet, but that's what they're trying to do. And in a press release concerning this particular situation, they had, I believe he's called the commissioner here. Let me think about that. I'm not sure what the title is of the lead person of the state police here in New York, but let's just say he's a commissioner. I don't know what it is. But whoever that was at a press conference when this was happening, they were talking about this, and a question was posed to him. If the governor gives the order for you to go out and seize guns, collects guns from the people, what are you going to do? And he got up to the mic and said he's going to remove the guns from the people. Okay, that's the difference between an individual who is ruled by the people and governed by his duty, is governed by the Constitution, versus an individual whose job relies on the governor. Guess what the governor is going to do if he didn't answer that way? He's going to find a new guy in his place. That's what's going to happen. So it's a very dangerous thing to try to get rid of. And they're working hard to get rid of our sheriffs. We got word that they're trying to do that out in Utah. Okay, I think it was Utah. We do know they're working on that in Maryland. They've done it in Connecticut. You know, we know that Hawaii and Alaska has never had sheriffs. Here in New York, we've had seven counties where the sheriffs were removed unconstitutionally, because here in New York and many state constitutions, and I don't believe all, but many or most state constitutions require the election of a sheriff. So it becomes a constitutional issue on the state level, too, in many places, not all. But nevertheless, without a sheriff, there is no common law. There is no executor of the process. There's no one to protect the unalienable rights of we the people. There's no one to make sure that the Constitution is enforced to protect us from our own elected officials. Well, we know how much problems we have with them already, and only because the sheriff doesn't know or understand his power and authority. If they understood their power and authority, we wouldn't have any of these problems. Because they would have corrected this a long time ago. And that's what we're trying to do, is to educate these sheriffs so they will start correcting these problems and bring things back onto true law and order, bring the peace back to the local. All right, any other questions?
Yeah, I'm going to shorten this one, and I would advise people when they send questions in, don't send paragraphs of information and basis, because there's just no time to read all that. But I did extract something really nice here, and you and or Brent may have some interesting comment here. But what exactly is the separation of church and state and its impact on the development of common law?
Oh, well, that's simple. Look, a church and state is controlled by particular religions and denominations. Basically, there are two major religions that really have came up in America, and that's Judeo-Christian religion. We acknowledge, though, and it was clear in the Declaration of Independence, we focused in on the Creator, the Governor of the Universe, and many people may see God from different perspectives and acknowledge God and the commandments. Look, at God says the commandments are written in your heart, so it's not just we Christians and Jews that have the Ten Commandments. Everybody has it. It's in their heart. Everybody knows it's wrong to kill and to steal and so on. So the law is already written in the hearts of all men, and whether they have Christ or not, or have the Bible or not, they can still participate, and they would come into agreement with the principles. Look at the principles that we build upon here in National Liberty Alliance, which we get from common law, is to come in with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy. Now, who can argue with that? Okay, anybody who truly believes in a God and is faithful and true to themselves will acknowledge the fact that God is just. He expects us to be just. God is honorable. He expects us to be honorable. God is merciful, and he expects us to be merciful. Who can argue with that kind of a thing? Now, if we had the church come in here, and, Jefferson spoke a lot about this. He was concerned. He didn't like the priesthood. He had a lot of our founding fathers, and I agree with it, because it really brings us back into the law of Rome. And you can also go back into Egypt and follow through priests and that kind of a thing. Well, right into Babylon. Babylon had priests, and many different religions that the Bible spoke about, where people come that were coming from religious backgrounds or whatever you want to call it. So we're not following doctrine here. We're just following the law of God, and that is the key here. Let's take where common law was originally discovered, where Jefferson discovered, which was coming down ultimately from the Germanic tribes. And they didn't have the Bible when they came into Britain. But they brought with them this idea of common law. They brought with them this idea of rule by God and not by man. And Jefferson was perplexed by this, wondering how is it that they could come to the conclusions that they had come to that were already in Israel, okay, through the going into Old Testament Israel. It was already there and through Christianity. How is it that they had these things and yet they didn't have the Bible? So it's very interesting. And so there's a perfect example of people who were not Jews or Christians and yet had the law of God. Now, it wasn't as quite fine-tuned as it became in Britain eventually over time, because when they met with the Bible, they immediately accepted the kingship of the Bible. They recognized it immediately, and rightly so, because it must have been where they must have originally come from. And, you know, we have the Lost Tribes of Israel. Maybe that's part of this whole thing. I don't know. But I remember Jefferson, if you read the real Thomas Jefferson, he speaks about this. If you look into the making of America, and they get into the discussion on how the founder of America was Thomas Jefferson, and as you read through, it was given to a small committee, which was led by Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, to adapt a national image, and which eventually became the eagle. But originally, in the beginning, it was given to them to discover something and come up with some kind of a national image. And both of them came up with the same thing, kind of a different way of looking at it, but they came up with the picture of Exodus, Moses and the Ten Commandments, and Moses coming out of Egypt, you know, crossing the Red Sea and having the Ten Commandments. Both of them had the very same thing, only they just had the pictures looked different. And you can get a look at those pictures in the book, The Making of America. I did trace it down on the internet and was able to find it on the internet also. So, I mean, you can find this. I'm trying to think what they call it. It's called the National Emblem, I think it's, or something like that. But it's, here it is. Hold on. Okay, let's see what this is called. Well, I'll just read this. Here is Franklin's description of the way he thought ancient Israel should be portrayed. Okay, and this is when they were talking about coming up for a national image for America. Moses standing on the shore and extending his hand over the sea, thereby causing the same to overwhelm Pharaoh, who is sitting in an open chariot, a crown in his head and a sword in his hand, raised from a pillar of fire of the clouds reaching to Moses to express that he acts by command of the deity. Motto, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. And so that is the, let's see what this is called. Okay, the Great Seal, that's what it is. That's what I was looking for. This was the proposal for the seal of the United States, and in this one was suggested as Benjamin Franklin. Now, Jefferson also came up with something very simple, it was very similar. Let's see if I got here. Mr. Jefferson proposed that the children of Israel in the wilderness, led by a cloud by day and a pillar by fire by night, and on the other side, Hengist, H-E-N-G-I-S-T, and Horsa, H-O-R-S-A, the Saxon chiefs from whom we claim the honor of being descended and whose political principles and form of government we have assumed. So that's what Jefferson said. So he had two sides to the coin. One was the Saxons, and the other side was Moses again. So anybody who says that we didn't come, this nation was created under some other source other than the Bible, doesn't know what they're talking about, and they really are just confused by the people who are giving them information who have no history at all. We can trace all this stuff back, and we do. And if you really want to understand and know this, go read the book that Brent wrote, which he'll be speaking in a few minutes, Excellence of Common Law, okay? And you can find it very clearly. We have these books listed on the internet, but I'm going to make them. I'm going to list them out in a few places where people can get them. Again, there's numerous books that we suggest good reading from. We have the real Thomas Jefferson, the real George Washington, the real Benjamin Franklin, The Making of America, Excellence of Common Law by Brent Winters, and a few other books that we suggest that people might want to read to get to the history of America, where we've come from. What happened was now when this committee came up with their findings and set it forth, whoever was leading this kind of set it aside. So the enemy was already working inside America. We know that. We saw that during the arguments of the Federalist and the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers. That the enemy already had their fingers in things. By God's mercy, they really didn't get much damage done. But they did prevent this from going forward. Because this committee was then put aside, and they went quite a few years without any kind of a seal. And then eventually a seal did come out, and they came out with the two-sided official seal, which shows the, you know, the pyramid on the one side. That kind of tells us a little something with the all-seeing eye. And underneath it says the New World Order. And then on the other side, an eagle holding arrows in one and a fig leaf in another. And so, again, you can get more information on this in the book, The Making of America. And you can find this at the National Center for Constitutional Studies. So the website to buy most of these books is www.nccs.net, nccs.net. So look at either we're going to have the America that our founding fathers set forward, which I personally agree with, and have your unalienable rights, which comes from God, not man, or you can have what Babylon has put out to the whole world, coming under the called the Roman law or the Justinian law, and maybe there's other laws. They also just call it civil law. And then you live under the rule of man, the thumb of man, and they give you rights, and they can change tomorrow. So you either receive your rights and the authority from men or from God. Who made man power over me? Who made any man power over you? We're all responsible for ourselves and our own lives, and we should have a government that acknowledges that and supports that. So anyway, all right, any other questions?
Yes, and they kind of blend together, so I'm going to read them in order since they were sent on two different days but by the same person. Is it admiralty jurisdiction without full contract disclosure equal to inland privacy? And does the U.S. Coast Guard have jurisdiction over inland piracy?
Read that again. Oh, inland piracy? Read that first part.
Regarding admiralty law of the sea.
Yeah, well, law of the sea is at sea. I don't know that you can bring the law of the sea into the rivers or anything. I never thought about that.
Well, supposedly we're underwater, John.
Well, we're far underwater at this point in time. We're drowning, in fact, in what they brought us. Look, this is just a way for them to bring and to get rid of the Constitution. The whole key is to get rid of the Constitution. Why do you think they're trying to bring us under martial law? Who goes under martial law but a conquered nation? Conquered nations are put under martial law to hold the peace and control the people until they can really set the grips of whatever government they're trying to set in place takes place. And they're going to be controlled by the military. That's what martial law is, controlled by the military. You could be brought out, set up against the wall, and shot. That's what happened all throughout Europe with when they were coming just to move another, when Hitler came in. He was taking control of nations and killing anyone who got in his way. So the martial law is, why do you think they're trying to push martial law? Who tries to, we wrote a paper on this, on gun confiscation, and every time a nation takes away the guns from the people, the weapons from the people, mass murder in the millions happen right after that. We have lists of nation after nation after nation after nation that this has happened to in the past 150 years or so. So there again, why are they trying to take our guns away? Why do they want to take our sheriffs away? Why do they want to take our common law away? Why do they want to demoralize us? Why do they want to remove God? Why do they want to remove the family? You know, the family, the family unit is a natural unit, but very, very heavily enforced in all religions. You must have the family unit. That's the structure and you know, the workings of a nation. You know, we find our integrity from our family. We want to protect our family. We want a government that's going to protect the laws and enforce the laws that's going to protect our family and ourselves. So, you know, why would anyone want any law under any man? What man is it out there? You know, the only man I can lead out to is Justinian, and all he did was take the law of Babylon and put it down into a writing so that it could be formulated and used by any tyrant that wants to control a nation, okay? Well, that's the only thing we can trace up to. You know, you can go into Egypt, and they had the priests set up and everything, you know, and it was all about control. It led up to men. It never worked out good anywhere in history. Find me a place in history where man writes the law, and it worked out well. It never does. It always ends horribly. The only place you can trace success is law, living law under God, living under God. 400 years of just unbelievable success Israel had, until they decided. What did they decide? They wanted a king like the other nations. And what did God say? Or what did Samuel say? You already got a king. It's King God. What are you talking about? Everything's been great. No, we want to be like the other nations. We want a man. We want a man king. God said, okay, give it to him. And everything went downhill after that. And where is Israel now? You know, what happened to them? So our nation, when we set up, you know, they did the same thing. They wanted to make George Washington king. He refused. No way. He already knew. He was already working with the rest of our founding fathers. He understood what we had to do here. We had something new happen. We wanted to get back under God, the rule of God, because there's no other way man can live in harmony and have laws that are just and right except for under God. There's no other way. Okay, any other questions?
That is it.
Okay. All right, with that, I'm going to move over to Brent, and Brent can spend as much time as he wants to talk about these subjects. He's much more knowledgeable in this area than I am. After all, he wrote this great book called The Excellence in Common Law, and I've got a lot of information that I understand things. It cleared a lot of things up for me by reading that book. Brent, are you here?
I'm here, if you can hear me.
We can hear you. Go right ahead, Brent. I'm going to mute up, and you could talk on this and see where we go with it. And if you take more time than necessary and want to just talk on this subject, and we could pick up on the other subject next week, it's all up to you. But go right ahead.
Well, thanks. I appreciate, again, you allowing me to come on here and relate what I've discovered and what I'm convicted about. The book, Excellence of the Common Law, is a history, a comparative law text tracing the two dominant traditions of religion, law, and government that have existed since the earliest days. I've traced them back in history to the founding, the settling of the city of Babylon, forward on every continent, and then focusing in the latter part of the book, it's almost 1,000 pages, on the struggle between those two traditions on the isle we call Britain. And that's where the drama of America eventually played out. But it did start, as John said, over on the continent of Europe. Fascinatingly, even the Anglo-Saxons and the Danes that came to England that dominated, along with the Celts that were already there, even in the pre-Christian days, they knew of the Bible. We know that because even, for example, in the book, The Saga of Beowulf, the villain, the monstrous villain in that story was a fellow, some kind of a creature, by the name of Grendel. And the saga acknowledges that Grendel is a descendant, a Cainite, a descendant of Cain somehow. Cain being the son of Adam and Eve that killed Abel and then was banished. And then, of course, he began the idea of founding of cities and drawing people in and eventually culminating in Babylon. And then at Babylon, the law of the city, the civil law, was first brought to sophistication. And there, the first true emperor of the race of man began his emperorship, his tyranny. His name was Nimrod. And Maitland, the Sir Frederick Maitland, among whom other students of comparative law, none greater, maybe some as great, but Maitland said, and I put this on the back of the book here. It's the back of the book, Excellence of the Common Law. He said, if we search out the origins of Roman civil law, we must study Babylon. If we search out the origins of Roman civil law, we must study Babylon. And Maitland was a comparative law student. His writing, voluminous, just constantly compared and contrasts the law of the land, our common law, with the law of the city, the civil law. And so did many other. Holdsworth did that throughout. And in England, Bede, the venerable Bede, shows the difference. He was the father of English history. I don't know that he really tried to. He just traced the history, and it comes out. But the history of the Isle of Britain is a history of a perpetual struggle between the courts of common law and the tribunals of Rome, the tribunals of Babylon, which, of course, were imported by the Roman Church, by the Pope, who sought to fulfill the domination of the world and still does. Through that law, the Roman civil law, the canon law of the Church of Rome, is the law of the code, the civil code of the Roman Empire, which, as we just said, compiled best by the Emperor Justinian. And he put it together, and now that code, that Roman code, the code of Justinian, rules almost every nation on the face of our planet in the form, in two forms, the Roman form, or the German form, called the Code of Bismarck, fashioned, or it's the Roman code, just tweaked, and Bismarck put his name on it about the year 1900, and the French form, called the Code Napoleon, which is all over the world. The country of Vietnam is governed by the Code Napoleon, but every communist country, Russia and China included, North Korea, and Japan, before them, had taken on the Roman code in its German form. And that's why the atrocities we see are permitted. That's why Nazism, the atrocities of Nazism occurred, because the German people took on the principles of the Code of Rome. And the countries that aren't governed by that law of the city code are governed by its principles. And all of Sharia law, now all of Talmudic, Pharisaical law, same thing, Pharisaical, Talmudic law, is Roman. It's the law of the city. It is Babylon. That's why they call it the Babylonian Talmud, because the principles of it are the same. We in today face an onslaught we've never faced before, never the strong. We face it right now, and it's coming on like gangbusters. And it is the combination together of the law of the evil empire under three labels: the law of Rome, Sharia law, and Talmudic law. It's coming at us hard, and all three are the same. All three arose in their modern forms from the Middle Ages. Mohammedes, the leading rabbi of Europe, St. Thomas Aquinas of Rome, and the Islamic sage of North Africa named Averroes, they were contemporaries, and they all promoted the Roman law, or the law of Babylon, through their respective labels. And don't know that they understood what they were doing. I don't have evidence of that. I do have a fairly long section of the book on the likelihood that they did know one another. But the other questions that were asked, for example, the impact of church and state on our common law, and this thing about, somebody asked about, they said, well, the common law, the law of England came, or the Britons or the Romans carried it, and when they departed, they left it hogwash. Hogwash. And I say that with great conviction. That's a term of art when I use it, hogwash. I know hogwash pretty good. I used to wait it when I was growing up most of my life. And I know what it is, and you want to get it out of the way, but hogwash piles up, and it floods us. And that's what our present system is attempting to do, lie to us about things like that. I don't say what I say on my own authority. There have been men much greater than me, much more intelligent, much more learned than myself. I just compiled the information, I did the research, and if people are interested in trying to understand who we are, this is important because it is our common law. As William Franklin Thatcher said in the Encyclopedia of Legal History, an article on comparative law, he said that our common law is among our greatest of blessings. Without it, we would not be who we are. This is the only thing that distinguishes us from the rest of the world. Only the English-speaking world has juries, and they've been done away. The grand jury has been done away with in England. And a lot of other things are being done away with. England did carry the torch, but England's going down, looks like. I hope they'd stop. Sharia law is pressing in on them hard. We're facing it, too. And if we don't bring common law to the forefront, and our common law, I say it often and it needs to be said, our common law is not a list of laws. Our common law was called the law of the land. And the law of the land, the phrase law of the land, lifted from Magna Carta, put in Article 6 of our Constitution, means due process of law. Our common law is not a list of laws. It is a way. It is a way of going about government. It is a way of going about resolving disputes. And that is called due process. The Bible lays it out over and over and over again that way. The law of God is a law of process. That's why Jesus Christ said, I am the way. He didn't say, I'm the law. That's why God says the Torah, the word Torah, the most comprehensive word in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Old Testament, Torah, means, it's from an ancient verb, of course, more ancient even than the Bible, as far as we can tell, before the Bible was written. It's an ancient verb, yet from the ancient verb, yirah, it means to point with the index finger. To point what? To point out the way. That's what it means. When John the Baptist cried out, behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world, you can just picture him with his finger pointed, pointing out the way, the Torah. That's what it's all about. And we are not, as a common law people, looking to do the will of government. I was reading today, I'm going through Blackstone again. I'm at the very end of the third volume, the section on equity courts. And he makes the comment, Blackstone makes the comment there, that we are a government not of will, but of law. We are a government, he says, not of will, but of law. Well, we've maybe heard that. I've heard that all my life. But I stopped and I thought today, and I said, now, wait a minute. All law is somebody's will. Somebody's, and that's true. Everyone will acknowledge that who's thought it through. And when we say all law, we are a government of will, not law, that's short, and that's a shortened form of the statement. We are not a government of the will of men, but of the law of God. Not of the will of men, but of the law of God, pre-established. And if we don't include God, I'm on the radio 6 days a week. Somebody called in and was complaining that some people like to listen to what I say when I talk about the Bible, and some don't. He was complaining about it. And I had to respond, and I said, and I say it here again, any approach to government that keeps God out of the mix keeps his will out of the mix. And if you keep his will out of it, then there's only one thing left to happen, and that's for men to establish their own will. And Paul the Apostle says it just that way, not seeking the will, that is the law of God, men set about, he says, to establish their own right way of doing things, their own right wiseness. Translating the Greek word, diakonos, not diakonos, but the word meaning justice or right. And you can't separate the two. You can't separate justice from right, and that Greek word is easily and rightly translated either way. Men's rights are their duties, and that is what is just. And Paul says, if you don't have the will of God, which is the law of God, if you don't pay attention to that, you'll go about to establish your own. Well, that's the will of men. And the will of men is cruel. The law of Rome is a cruel law. It is the law that permits tyrants. Oh, they're careful not to always show themselves. But when they have to, they will. Well, I did want to talk about habeas corpus. I wanted to mention, I'm going to, John, briefly,
spend as much time as you want on this subject. Go ahead.
Okay, just real quick. Habeas corpus is arguably the greatest principle necessary for our liberty, among the greatest. I don't know if you could say it is the greatest, but it certainly prevents tyranny. It prevents it. If it's there, the writ of habeas corpus, and I'm reading from my book, my commentary on the Constitution, if you're interested in looking more about habeas corpus, there's a lot in the comparative law text about it, and there's a lot, one of my longer sections is the section of Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2. Section 9, Article 1, Clause 2, says the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, when in cases of rebellion or invasion of the public safety may require it. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended. I want to camp on that. Shall not be suspended. Now, some have asked, why is this privilege of writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended? Why is that language put in Article 1? Article 1, you remember, is about the power, the legislative power, Congress, the Congress of the United States. Why isn't it put in a Bill of Rights? Well, the reason is because Article 1 gives us, of course, the powers of Congress. The powers of Congress, the powers allowed Congress, that's Section 8. And then Section 9 are the powers denied Congress. The powers allowed Congress, and in general, then after that, is the powers denied Congress. It says here, the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended, thus denying Congress of power. But then it says, unless, when in cases of rebellion or invasion of the public safety may require it. But still, that's a limitation on Congress, and that's why it's put there in the first article, because the writ of habeas corpus is called the great writ. Well, let's break it down real quick. What is a writ? A writ, maybe somebody remembers that, one of the last movies of John Wayne, he played a federal marshal by the name of Rooster Cogburn. And he was doing what John did well in some of his movies, maybe outside of the movies, but he was drinking. And he was pretty tipsy. And he said that he was going to serve a writ. That was a job to serve process as a U.S. Marshal. And he said he was having trouble with rats, and he said he had a writ for a rat. And a writ is short for the word writing. It is a writing. Because that which is put into writing to the ancients, especially the ancient Anglo-Saxons and Danes, that which is put into writing has authority. It had a special authority with them way back when they did their runes on pieces of wood. And I have a long section of that to try to describe where we get some of these words and these concepts. Runes. And that's, but the writing, the writ, is a command. A writ at common law is a higher authority commanding a lower authority to do something. A writ is a higher authority commanding a lower authority to do something. And it says here that the privilege of that writ shall not be suspended. Now, if you want a higher court or a court which is higher than a jailing power to issue a writ, that is a command, to unjail somebody, to turn them loose, you ask them to issue to the jailer a writ of habeas corpus. A writ of habeas corpus. The writ of habeas corpus is our weapon against any jailing power. It doesn't have to be the government. It can be anybody. I had somebody contact me recently and said they needed my help. I said, what's the matter? Said, well, I know of a lady who has 8 children. She was homeschooling her children. I don't have all the details of the case yet. But somehow the government got on her back, and she maybe got on their bad side. I don't know, but they ended up putting her in the hospital, drugging her, taking away all her children. She's been there for 10 years. And this lady who was concerned and her husband came to me and said their family's beside themselves. Her children are grown, some of them now. They want to do something. They won't let her go. Now they've performed a tracheotomy on her, and they believe it so that she can't talk. Is there anything you can do? Well, the first thing I thought, the writ of habeas corpus. Because somebody is holding, imprisoning that woman within a boundary, that's the definition of false imprisonment, against her will. And when that happens, this is the fascinating thing about the writ of habeas corpus. By the way, it's only available in the English-speaking world, common law countries, and it's not even available in Scotland, just as an example, because Scotland's under the Roman civil law, with some common law overglosses because of Parliament's power. But habeas corpus is not there, but it is in England, and it is in the United States. Although in England, habeas corpus has gotten so weak. Habeas corpus means, habeas means we should have, Latin, we should have, and corpus means body, corpus. We should have the body. It is a writ from the court to the jailer saying, bring us the body of the prisoner. Bring him bodily into this court. Well, in England, they don't bring him bodily into the court anymore. They just file the petition. They call it the same thing, and then the lawyers go in and argue about it, and the fellow sits in jail. But the habeas corpus in our country has always been, you bring the prisoner before the court and prove why, if his jailing is under good authority. Well, at any rate, that's what this, it doesn't have to be the government, doesn't have to be a county jail, doesn't have to be the city jail, doesn't have to be a federal prison, doesn't have to be a state prison. It could be, as in the case I'm thinking about, a hospital. It doesn't even have to be a hospital, or it could be anybody who's falsely jailing somebody. When they receive that writ from the court saying, bring the body of that person here forthwith, and you, the jailer, better explain, you better have a good reason, good authority, why you're holding them. And if you aren't, the reason the body of the prisoner, by the way, is to be brought, so that if the court rules that there's no authority to hold them in jail, that the court has the power to release them on the spot. And no, the jailer can't say, like I know they'd want to do, well, we got to take him back to the jailhouse and process him out. No, that's not the writ of habeas corpus. That's the kind of thing they're doing in England now. We don't do that. You know, it's gotten so bad. Here's another ruse the government uses. You know, in federal courts often, there's a courtroom built right at the federal court, a federal courtroom, so that the prisoner doesn't have to be taken to court. They're just brought to the courtroom. Well, that's a violation, in my humble opinion, of the writ of habeas corpus. There are a lot of ways to get around, creative ways to get around fundamental rights, but the writ of habeas corpus, if you don't have it, the executive power of the government or anybody by any means can jail people anywhere. You've all heard the story of that fellow. What was his name? I'm not saying I supported everything he did. I'm no student of him, but they did keep him. Oh, I know one. Here's one. Well, there's two of them I can think of. One of them ran for United States president from federal prison down in Georgia. He was born in my neck of the woods. His name was, it's escaped me. He was the father of unionism. But he was jailed by Woodrow Wilson because he spoke out against World War I. Other people have been jailed in hospitals. I'd mentioned that. But the writ of habeas corpus in those kinds of cases, if it can't be suspended, if it can't be done away with, you can always petition the court to get out of jail if a tyrant tries to throw you in for what you've said or what you've done that's otherwise lawful. And that's the trouble we're facing now. In federal court now, habeas corpus has a statute of limitations on it. There's another trick they've learned to use very recently since the 9/11. You only got a year. You've only got a year if you got thrown in federal court or federal prison to file habeas corpus. Well, I think that's a violation of the Constitution of the United States the way I read it. Well, the question comes, then who has the power to suspend this right to petition the court to issue the writ of habeas corpus? And Justice Joseph Story says, well, according to the Constitution, only Congress has that right. They're the ones that, it's in Article 9, he says this in his commentaries, but he says only Congress has that right. And he also says that this right is available to any person, American citizen or not, wherever the government of the United States or any of the states chooses to act, whether it be on the other side of the world or whether it be here. The writ of habeas corpus is available. The history of our writ of habeas corpus is long and colorful. And it came to the absolute forefront during the war between the northern and the southern tiers of the states. And Abraham Lincoln suspended it, jailed over 700 people very quickly, without trial, arrested them secretly, and jailed them and held them throughout the duration of the war. Indeed, arrested the entire state legislative assembly of the state of Maryland so that they couldn't take a vote on whether or not to secede from the Union. Well, and also then other men. One was sentenced to death in Indiana, a militiaman arrested, sentenced to death, went all the way to the Supreme Court. Without a trial, by the way, sentenced by a military tribunal. That's without a trial. And the Supreme Court of the United States, Justice Stephen Fields, writing the majority opinion, I believe, at least he signed on to it, but I read what he said about it later. He said he couldn't believe that he was attacked in the newspaper so viciously for upholding this man's right to the writ of habeas corpus and right to a trial, because feelings ran so high and that the legal literature came out against him. Well, that's what we're facing today. People whose brains, for whatever reason, they are deluded. They are deluded. Deluded away from what I call common sensibilities. Either the Constitution of the United States is our law of the land, the way things are supposed to be done, or it isn't. And there's a large faction of people who make fun of people who think the Constitution should have authority, who think that we should demand that people be qualified, for instance, to run for president. But habeas corpus has faced that. It's been to the forefront now. Things never change. Since the war on terror, habeas corpus has been in front of the American people. And the question is, who's entitled to it? Is everybody entitled to it? Justice Field, the Supreme Court said yes, everybody's entitled, even in times of war. Even in times of war, if, he says, the common law courts are open. If the common law courts are open, and the military tribunals have no jurisdiction over the matter, no summary judgments, no drumhead courts like they did to that fellow in Indiana, sentenced him to death without a jury. That's what military court's all about. So the writ of habeas corpus is extremely, extremely important. Now, let me read a quote out of the book here. I like to quote other people other than myself. It gives it a little more punch, I think, but I could. Something that would capture it. Capture it, and I'll sum up with this. Well, here we go. This is Justice Joseph's story. Let me read what he said. To understand the meaning of the habeas corpus clause, listen to him close. It will be necessary to have recourse to the common law. To understand the habeas corpus clause, it will be necessary to have recourse to the common law, for in no other way can we arrive at the true definition. It is justly esteemed the bulwark of personal liberty, applied in every case of illegal restraint, for every restraint upon a man's liberty is, in the eyes of the law, an imprisonment. Wherever may be the place, or whatever may be the manner in which the restraint is effected. It doesn't make any difference who it is. It doesn't make any difference where. The writ of habeas corpus is our bulwark, it says, of personal liberty. And remember, Blackstone defined personal liberty most fundamentally as freedom of locomotion to go where you want to go. That means get up and walk away. And if you're falsely imprisoned, you can't. Now, one other thing I want to add, didn't want to forget. I jotted this down earlier, and then I'll end with this. The writ of habeas corpus is like the writ quo warranto. Both of those writs demand that somebody justify with good authority why they're doing what they're doing. The writ quo warranto, that's what quo warranto means. Quo, by what? Warranto, authority. By what warrant? How do you warrant this? What's your authority for doing this? And the writ quo warranto is filed to bring the government, some government agent or person into court and answer, justify why they did what they did. And if he can't justify it, then the court will go against him. Well, the writ of habeas corpus is very much similar. That demands the jailer, the jailing power, produce the body of the prisoner before the court and justify, again, by what authority? Do you have good authority to jail this person? But here's how the writ of habeas corpus differs from quo warranto. Quo warranto demands that the person who's been injured be the party that files the action, the petition. But the writ of habeas corpus can be filed by someone other than the person who's injured and who is suffering in jail. This lady that was put in jail or falsely imprisoned, this lady that was put in a hospital, and they performed a trach on her, and they kept her there 10 years. She's not in any position to file and request release, as would be anybody in jail if the jailing power doesn't want them to communicate with the court. They won't let them. And that's why somebody else can do it on their behalf. And that's often the way it's done. The most famous case is the Somerset case, the Virginia slave that went to England. And somebody filed a writ for him, said he was being falsely imprisoned because his master, slavery was against the law in England. And there have been other slave cases like that that then came down in America. But such is the writ of habeas corpus, very powerful. The thing that we need to do is make sure that we just understand its fundamentals. Its fundamentals. What is it? Do you have a grasp on what it is? Because if you don't, you're not going to protect it. But it is called the Great Writ, as Thomas Jefferson said and others. Well, thanks, John. Again, I appreciate you allowing me to come on and be a guest and talk. I relish the opportunity.
All right, thanks a lot, Brent. We're going to go to an open forum, so if you have time for questions, let me get the Q&A started. Anybody who would like to ask a question, make a comment to Brent, hit *6, and we'll unmute you. Again, *6 to ask a question to Brent. Okay, we got one person here, 678. When we unmute you, maybe you can give us your first name and your state. Go ahead, you got the mic. 678, area code. Area code 678. You got the mic?
Georgia Eric, can you hear me?
Yep, go right ahead.
Yes.
Brent, I had a question for you. Before, I wanted to ask John if he could answer a little bit later. Can you be a grand jury administrator and a legislator? That's a question for later. And then the one I have for Brent is about, you were discussing it last week, and the prison system. You had brought it up, but you strayed away from it because you wanted to answer the question about something else. Here it is. Neither the Volkerite nor Scripture advocates a prison system to punish or deter crime. I wanted you to talk about that and also see if you could tie it into, your capital crimes, the biblical standards. You talk about the Sanhedrin, and I think there's three points you make about how we could avoid having unjust executions. You could answer, put those together, or just answer one of them. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, we'll start with the last one. That's one my mind's flooded with. Capital punishment, clearly, the law of God written, or as Justice Joseph Story calls it, revealed religion. It's part of the law, but amazingly, most fascinatingly and curiously, the process that attaches to capital crimes in the Bible that must take place before a capital crime ever occurs is overwhelming. And that is why we have no record outside of the Bible in history of anyone ever being stoned to death or executed under the law of God. We have none. And the reason is because the process isn't followed. Case in point. It's a dubious passage in the Bible to some because it doesn't appear in the extremely oldest manuscripts, Codex A and Vaticanus. But it does appear in most all manuscripts, and that's the last verse of John chapter 7 throughout John chapter 8. And that's the story of the woman caught in the very act of adultery, caught doing it right in bed. And the law of God said that if a person's caught doing something like that, they're subject to capital punishment. And so the Pharisees, the Sanhedrin guys, they took this woman who they had caught her themselves, apparently, and they drug her out and threw her down on the ground in front of the Messiah himself, Jesus Christ. And they said, "What shall we do? This woman was caught in the very act." And if you remember the story, ultimately he said, "You who are without sin among you, cast the first stone." Well, they didn't cast any stones. And the reason they didn't cast any stones was because the law of God, and Jesus never broke the law of God, never advocated changing any of it, because the law of God demands due process, and due process says this in those cases of adultery. If the accusers or the accuser will not start the execution process of stoning, then the execution is not to take place. And those fellows, like a judge today, wouldn't want to trip. He'd be never the one that would trip the death trap on a scaffold. He'd never be the one to fire the bullet into the heart of the man. He'd never be the one to throw the switch. These fellows, they didn't want to dirty their fingers with blood. But as a matter of fact, you know, blood money was abhorrent to them, although they would manipulate and make sure people got killed. But they themselves wanted to keep their hands clean of blood. But the Bible says, if you're the accuser, that means you're the witness. That's what the accuser is, the one that caught the woman in the act. If you won't do it, nobody is to do it. And add to that, can you imagine standing with a rock in your hand and you're the accuser and there are 500 people behind you? And you think, well, should I start this execution or not? Because the chances of you getting stoned to death if you started the execution are just as strong as if you didn't, or as if you did, if you did start it. So the processes that God gives us are so much higher than we want to consider. They're so perfect, as David said, that if we would but follow them, there'd be very few executions in the United States. So we have a common law due process. That's something they don't know anything about, the law of the city in most of the world. They use window dressing of all kinds. They even have statutes in other countries that say they have the writ of habeas corpus, but they don't have this. They don't have what the common law has. The common law says it can't be suspended. And then the exceptions are given, and those are. But at Roman civil law, the government can suspend them anytime they want, arbitrarily, without any reason. No emergency need be, no war, no public safety need to be at issue. They just have window dressing, and they have window dressing for due process. But these Pharisees, in that particular case, the enemies of Jesus Christ, they wanted to do away with due process and just say, we think she ought to be killed. Let's just kill her. That's the end of the law. That's where we're going with this thing. The ends justifies the means. Let's just do it. And he pointed out to them, no, God has a way of doing things, and it is the way, the process. As our common law says, the course of the common law. We call it the law of the land. That's the course of the common law, due process. And so that's why I would say that very few capital punishments would occur if we use the process that God particularly gives us. And then the other thing you'd mentioned is jails. No, the Bible, dungeons and jails are for the evil empire. Dungeons and jails. You go to the bowels of Egypt, and Joseph was thrown in a dungeon. And at common law, jails are not part of the tradition. In America, we didn't have a prison system here. Didn't have one. I was talking, about de Tocqueville? He came here, a French aristocrat, said nice things about America, but he was on a mission sent by the French government to discover what the Quakers had given America. The Quakers in Pennsylvania, who had a false view of mankind. They claimed to be Christian. Maybe they were, but they sure didn't have this understood. They said, you take a man who's a bad man, lock him in a room with a Bible, tell him to pray, and when he comes out, he'll be reformed. Why? Because he has a spark of goodness in him. Well, the Bible doesn't teach that. And anybody that's been to prison knows better. And so they called these places where they locked people up with Bibles places of penance. Places of penance. And now we call them penitentiaries. And we still call them that until recently. We have a new word now. It means the same thing. Correctional facility, like we're going to correct people. And again, anybody that's been to jail, I think I'm probably talking to some people that have been, you know the facade of all of that and the farce of all of it. Prisons are places where people learn crime, learn how to become hard. And God doesn't authorize them, and you won't find them in the law of God. You'll find men put in ward, held for trial. You'll find that at the common law. Now, in England, that was abused. Sometimes they'd hold men for trial for up to 20 years. And that was the way they got around it, and they just wouldn't ever bring the trial. That's why bail is in our Constitution. It's part of our common law. And if in habeas corpus, if you bring a guy in, if he comes in for habeas corpus and the judge says to the jailer, give us authority while you're holding him. Do you have good cause? And he doesn't. He has good cause. He says, well, he's indicted for a crime. And then the judge is supposed to say, according to the rules of habeas corpus, well, let's see if we can bail him then. Can we bail him? And then the arguments begin. But that's why we have bail, is because we don't believe that men ought to be imprisoned. We have today, at the federal level, what we call the Speedy Trial Act. The Speedy Trial Act, passed back in the 80s, because Congress said, we have never in our country realized the right of Amendment 6 of our Constitution, the right to a speedy trial, so they passed an act called the Speedy Trial Act. It's never been used. It's been justified every way but Sunday how to get around it. The courts simply, I've been in court and argued it. They don't really pay much attention to it. They say they do. They give it window dressing. But why is the Speedy Trial Act so important? Why? Because men awaiting trial need not be kept in jail. The trial must come quickly. Men languish in prison. Listen, if you're in prison, you're forgotten. Even your own family and friends, they may love you, but it's dangerous to go visit people in prison, and it's depressing. And the people, I've known people in prison that have been there 10, 20 years, and they forbid their family to come and see them. Why? Because it's harder on them for their family, their wives, their children to come see them than it is to just forget about it. Because every they stay for an hour, walk away, or stay for a day, it's too hard on them. They don't want it. I understand that. Jail is ugly. It's part of the devil system. It's part of the evil empire. And God doesn't give us that option to do in the Bible. And amazingly, at common law, we didn't have that option either. And when people came to America, gaols and jails were for holding people for trial. They were not, as a matter of law anyway, even though there were abuses. That wasn't part of the punishment that the law dealt out to wrongdoers, was jail. God gives us many other ways to deal with it. Well, there is one thing that people say come close. That's the cities of refuge. If you inadvertently kill a man, for example, the Bible uses the fact pattern, you're out chopping wood with your neighbor, cutting wood for the winter, or just cutting wood, and the axe head flies off the helve with a handle and hits your neighbor in the head and kills him, and well, then his brothers and his friends think you killed him, then they come after you to kill you. If you run into one of these cities and stay, then you're safe. And there's a bunch of rules that go with that. People say that's false imprisonment. No, it isn't. You can leave the city anytime you want. You're just doing it at a great peril if you do it, because if somebody kills you before the high priest dies, that's in office at that time, then he's justified in killing you. So you're smart to stay there. But again, that's not imprisonment. You can leave if you want, if you have to, for whatever reason, or run away to another country, or whatever you want to do. But this thing about jails is godless. It destroys everything. Who suffers when people go to jail? Families. Does the man in jail suffer? Oh, he suffers some. Maybe it's so rotten that that's the only thing we can do with him. Well, if it's that bad, then there are ways to deal with capital punishment. If you follow due process, that is. Be very careful. If we violate the standards of God, we're going to pay a price. Whatever they are, we must pick out the first principle. I said to my daughter tonight, tell me, what's the first principle? The Bible says you're not supposed to yoke up together a jackass and an oxen. What's the first principle? Do I have a jackass and an oxen that I am tempted to do that? No. Well, Paul tells us these two principles. Number one, the laborer is worthy of his hire, and he says that if you, well, I'm going to another one. My mind's racing. He says, that's another analogy. He says you're not to be unequally yoked to an unbeliever. Well, that can be applied in two ways. Marriage and business partnerships. And there's a whole lot that goes with that that needs to be discussed. To follow the law of God takes contemplation. You can learn the first principle, but the question is, how do you apply it here and now? Well, jails aren't part of the application of God. You won't find them anywhere in the Ten Commandments, and you won't be able to infer from the Ten Commandments and get to jails as a right way of dealing with things.
Okay.
And that's why it's not part of our common law.
Okay, thanks for the question, and we'll move on to the next person. Let's see. Next is, looks like Brad from Pennsylvania. Go right ahead, Brad.
Hey, John, actually, I wanted it for the other section of the Q&A. So whoever's
okay,
next,
okay.
You can go ahead.
All right, we'll go to the next then. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, the next person is 780. Maybe you can give us your first name and your state. But before you do that, let me just quickly respond to this question that was asked about the legislator, being a legislator and becoming an administrator for the grand jury and the trial jury. That would be a conflict of interest. Becoming an administrator would become a full-time job, and you cannot be politically connected in that sense. It definitely would be a conflict of interest. But anyway, okay, the next person, 760, give us your first name and your state.
Thank you, John. California, Dave.
Dave, how you doing? Go right ahead.
Okay, I want to welcome our presenter back. We really appreciate being with us. I want to continue our discussion from a week or two ago. I love what you say about applying the ancient principles to the here and now, and I want to continue give you an opportunity to continue your thoughts and perhaps, you know, with John, continue your thoughts about how we can apply to the here and now to bring forth those public servants with the guns and the badges that we want to be on our side, the sheriffs and or the marshals. How can we, you know, as quickly as practical, bring them forth to bring forth our remedy? Can you share with us how a pathway from where we are to bringing forth these humble, God-fearing, Constitution-following public servants with guns, the sheriffs and the marshals, to bring us back to where we need to be? Thank you.
Well, all we can do is present the truth. And but I say all we can do, that's a lot, because that produces guilt. Let him that has ears hear. Some of them will hear if they're prone to hear, and some of them won't. We live in a police state culture, and those folks that work in courthouses, my experience has been around rural courthouses, and I was a prosecutor for a short period of time, finished up a man's term. I've probably mentioned this before, but I discovered when I got in that job, I was trying to help him out because he had to leave, but I discovered that there's a culture even in these little courthouses, and the culture is it's us against them. I discovered that also, and all the sheriff's deputies, they all get in on the act. I discovered that also when I went to federal court once to file some papers, and the clerk of the court was very kind, trying to help me, and she made a comment about a big case they had going there, and she said, "We seldom lose these cases. We seldom lose these cases." And I'm thinking, "We? You're the court. The court's not supposed to take sides and join the prosecutorial team, but they do." And then she feels like, because she works for the judge, she's part of the prosecuting team. That's called violation of separation of power. The prosecutor is the executive branch, but we as Americans, we aren't learning that in the eighth grade like we some of us at some time did. I had to take a Constitution test when I was in high school and get out of high school. And I don't know that the people that required that were so meritorious. It might have been a vestige of the past they didn't care about. I learned a lot, but that's the kind of thing that we need to have going now. How do we do it? One of the things that I hear these sheriffs, ones that are right-headed, say, and legislators, by the way, I know some, they say that I took a course way back 25 years ago. This guy offered a course on the Constitution, and it opened my eyes. I've heard sheriffs and state legislators say this. Some of them are older now. Some are out of office. But it opened my eyes that I'm responsible personally to not violate people's rights. Well, that's important. Well, so what happened in that case? Well, somebody told them the truth. And in those cases, I knew who some of them were, and who they ended up going to these classes with. It wasn't done by the government. I also know, for example, a judge at home who's now retired, who used to teach for free courses about the Constitution to local law enforcement officers. He didn't do it for the right reasons, and I don't think he was saying the right things. But my point is, that's one thing we can be doing. That's why I take the opportunity I have to come on here. If somebody's listening, I feel fortunate. Maybe somebody will hear the truth. I don't want my life to be over and look back and say I didn't do what I could. It's up to all of us. If you know something, promote it a little bit. Say it. Teach it. And if we can, organize what we present into a book. Or if you can organize it into a book, or maybe somebody wants to organize a course, or we do those kind of things. And I try to do those kind of things. I mentioned this. I want to mention it again. I've got about 40 hours. I went through Magna Carta, blow by blow, clause by clause. And it's airing right now on Liberty Works Radio. I think we're up out of about, I think they're up to 15, hour number 15 now. And we can provide those to you on DVD, and you can listen to them. It's not that I know everything that can be known about Magna Carta, or I've got the final word on it. Far from that. But I am talking about it, and I'm telling people things they don't know. All I have to know is a little more than them. Well, I've taken time to learn a little more, so I'll present it, and maybe somebody else can add more sophistication to it. But we need to be saying it. The truth must be said. That's why we have freedom of speech. We to try to hammer these sheriffs, and I do agree that sheriffs are the important point. The police officers that murdered that fella up in Oregon here recently, 7 shots, 7 times they fired unarmed, they were given orders to do that. What do state police do? Well, they're myrmidons. They're just like machines. They follow orders or they lose their job. They're dependent for their positions and pay. They're kept men. So they murdered a man because they were told to by the first lesbian governor of the country, whatever her name is up there. That's all we're facing. And if they can do it to a Mormon, they'll do it to anybody. So don't think if they can do it to people you like or don't like, it doesn't make any difference. They can do it to you. But sheriffs, unlike the police, state policemen, are beholden to the voters. There's an advantage to that. It doesn't always work. There are a lot of sheriffs that don't get it. Maybe most, probably most. But the ones I've talked to who do get it, they were taught, or they took an opportunity. They want to learn about the Constitution. The evil empire, the evil empire has come down upon like a load of bricks, destroyed their lives, got them thrown off the police force or the sheriff's department. We've got too many sheriffs. I read an article not long ago demanding that we disarm police officers. Well, now people say that's crazy. No, that's not crazy. Police officers weren't allowed to carry guns in America until the 1840s, to any degree anyway, because we in America here, that's a common law doctrine. We have a vestige of it in England, the bobbies. The bobbies in London have always been known for being unarmed because they're Englishmen, and the English people didn't let policemen carry guns. Now it's, of course, just a token. But here in America, we didn't do it either until the cities, the people in the cities said, oh, we demand you have to have guns. Well, it started in New York. Well, I remember the story. But it spread. But we in America said, no, we're armed. We don't want the government armed. If the government's armed and they disarm us, then we're in bad shape. Well, then the government got armed, and now we're both armed. And what's happening? They want us disarmed. And the only reason, as somebody famously said, I'm quoting, the only reason anybody would want to disarm you is so they could do something to you that they could not otherwise do if you were equipped to prevent it. That's the only reason. There can be no other reason. Indeed, there isn't. And police officers, it's funny, I listen to police officers, government, prison guards, people like that. Man, they're big on the Second Amendment. Listen to them talk. And they're the very people that are bent upon destroying the Second Amendment. That's the madness and the inconsistency, the confusion, the, what will we call it, the delusion. You know, a great deluder is deluded first himself. And those in government who want to scream about the Second Amendment, military men, same way. I'm a 13-year military veteran, but I see the madness. Military men are the ones who want to talk about how great the Second Amendment is. Well, how many of them would follow orders if they were to disarm people? We live in a time of terrible confusion. Don't be confused. There's only one standard, and that's the will of God. And it comes in two volumes. The laws of nature, our Declaration of 76 puts it this way, the laws of nature unwritten in creation, and the laws of nature's God written in our Bibles. There is no other revelation, no other true law. And if the laws we have do not conform, are not consonant with those principles, we're going to pay a horrible price, and that price is tyranny and death. Because what happened to that guy in Oregon could happen to anybody. Indeed, it does happen all over the country. That just got a little bit of press. It happens every day.
All right, thanks, Brent. Would you like to take another one or two more questions?
Yeah, if you've got one or two more, I can hold out a little longer.
Okay. All right, well, we'll take one, maybe two more. Let's see. Okay, next question here, let's see, is 573 area code. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Yeah, this is Buckley in Missouri. I wish I had more time, but I'm on my way out the door running late for work. Is there some way I can get a hold of you by email or phone during the week?
Go to the website, www.commonlawyer.com, commonlawyer.com, and there's a contact button. You can hit that, and you can send an email, and it'll get to me. I don't maintain the web page, but it will get to me.
Okay. Commonlawyer.com.
Commonlawyer.com. You type that in, it'll come right to the top.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
You bet. Bye.
Okay, we'll take one more person for Brent. Terry from Colorado. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, John. And thank you. So nice to be able to talk to you. I see several places where something I thought was common law, and the division I had of common law, and it ends up being something in civil law. And I don't quite know how to say that, but just for grins, I found the word sheriff reading in Daniel 3:2 and 3:3 yesterday, and so it made me think: how did the word sheriff, get into the Bible in Daniel 3:2 and 3:3? Do you have any ideas on that?
Yes, of course. Those are Hebrew Aramaic words translated, especially in Daniel. Because then Daniel and Ezra is where the Aramaic passages are. But those are not sheriff. The reason the word sheriff is used there is because the people that translated the King James Bible were men, English men, that lived in England, spoke English. They understood what a sheriff was, and they were looking for a word that would approximate that Aramaic idea, because he's talking there about Babylon. They didn't have sheriffs in Babylon, but that's the word that they thought that the listeners or the readers of their day would understand. So don't try to equate the two. The Bible's fascinating because of course it's fascinating, but it compares and contrasts throughout. The Bible is a comparative law text. It compares and contrasts throughout the law of Babylon and the law of God. The law of the land. The land is what God's interested in. And he doesn't like cities. He says he's going to destroy every city on the face of the planet. That's in Revelation in the end. And there will be only land. There will be no seas. No, of course, that would mean there's no admiralty jurisdiction. There will be no seas. Fascinating statements that aren't given much attention. But the only city that's mentioned, second number of times in comparison to Jerusalem, is Babylon, because the theme of the Bible, the flow of the revelation of God, is this antagonism between the law of the land and the law of the city. Why? Because the true God, the true lawgiver, as James says in his epistle, is the God of all creation, and his will is the true law. His will is the true law. And the evil empire has the will of man for law. And so the Bible is a constant clashing, the story of the clashing, the explanation by biography, by history, by poetry, by letters, epistles, explaining and showing and demonstrating and revealing the difference between the law of the land and the law of the city. That is the theme of the Bible. And so to not pay attention to that is to be wholly ignorant. Wholly ignorant. It is to be uneducated. You want to be an educated man or woman? Concentrate on the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. Forget all the punky professors, all the dinky doctors. That's not where it's at. Ever learning, says the Apostle Paul, but never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Oh, they know a lot. They just refuse to accept the conclusions that their knowledge drives them to, ever learning, unable, not that they won't. Paul says they can't. Why? Because their eyes haven't been opened. It is inability. He takes the word dunamis, which means potential power, and he puts an alpha in front of it, an alpha privative. Dunamis means able. Adunamis means unable. And that's what he says about those guys. So you yourself, though, have the opportunity to be truly educated, to be an educated man, to be educated to exercise discernment, which is the mark of a free man. There were only two kinds of education throughout the history of the world, the education for the slave and the education for the freeman. The education for the slave made him a civilian. The education for the freeman made him a free man exercising freemanship, citizenship versus freemanship. Citizenship is an old Roman Latin word. It means civil. Citizen is from the word civil, meaning city, to be part of the city, to be under the thumb, the subjection of another man, his will substituted for yours. God says your will is good will as long as it comports with mine, not somebody else's. You know, the world is just a conglomeration, a mishmash of men trying to conform to each other's will. While one man's conforming to another man's will, that man, unbeknownst to the first man, is trying to conform to his will, trying to follow what he does. And we're looking for a leader, and we're running around like chickens with our heads cut off. We're wandering in the wilderness, as it were. And God says, no, I don't want you to pay attention to other men. I want you to pay attention to me. Me. I'm the only one that counts. You must please me. And if you're a man pleaser, you're wanting to have the latest fashion, the latest literature, know about the latest movie, you'll remain ignorant and trivial all your life, inconsequential and insignificant. The only way you can have significance as a creation of God, a member of the race of Adam, your significance comes from your commitment to true law. And every man must be, to have that significance, must be a lawyer. What does that mean? That means he's a man who wants to know the will of the true lawgiver. And it's revealed to us in two volumes. In the law, in nature, the nature of things, we call that our common law, and in our Bibles. And many of the things that you see, of course, the law of Rome has many standards that the common law, we would say the common law has. But that's not what distinguishes them. What distinguished the two, these two traditions, of which there are only two, right and wrong? There are only two. The wrong one's under many different labels, and the evil empire will have professors and college courses teaching you all these different kinds of government. No, there's only two. A lot of people say that the evil empire is just collectivism. They recognize that they're all just, it's a mishmash of different labels. But you see standards, for example, you're not supposed to murder people under the law, under the code of Rome. Boy, God said the same thing. But the difference comes in this. If you get accused of murder in a Roman law country, a law of the city country, you don't get any due process, no due process. There is no jury, and your lawyer has no real way to defend you. In a common law country, we have due process. That's why I say our common law is due process, and that's what distinguishes us from the rest of the world. Due process is the most important thing in our tradition of law, because things that are not done according to the right process are of no consequence. The verdict is worthless. But if you follow the process that God sets forth, God says, I will ratify the result. And he says, it's not your judgment in such a case. It becomes mine. I take responsibility for it. But if we don't follow the process, then God's not going to take the responsibility. Well, who is? We are. And that goes on the individual label. I don't want to miss this point. I want to say this at the end. I like to say this a lot. The only remedy to lawlessness is law. The only remedy to lawlessness, and that's what we see around us right now, confusion, lawlessness, the only remedy is law. And that means simply this, that you have a love of what is true law. And you yourself, personally, moment by moment, focus on doing what God wants you to do, the way he wants you to do it. We can try to talk about government, and we want government to change, but the way government's going to change is if the political government, is if the government of our lives change. That's what changes things. We got to start right there.
Because if we don't even know what the standard is, and then to do it is to really know it, it won't spread to those that are called to task, that are wielding and have a hold of the levers of power over us. That's what we want to change. The only remedy to lawlessness is true law, and it only comes in two volumes, the laws of nature, unwritten in creation, and the laws of nature of God written in the Bible.
Well, amen. Okay, thank you, Brent. Appreciate your time and your visit with us, and Lord willing, we'll see you next week again. So we're now going to move to our regular open forum. If anybody has any questions or comments, you can hit *6, and you'll get into the queue, and we'll try to respond to your questions. So we'll take our next. Unmute the person who was last on. I had to mute you because we're getting feedback. Did you have any other final commentary?
Oh, no. Thank you very much, Brent. I appreciate you going off just a little bit on that, and it really hit me. It was good for me. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's take our next caller. We have 719 area code. Go right ahead. You got the mic. What's your question?
Hello, this is Mike Hiram from Colorado. How are you folks tonight?
Good. How you doing? You said your name was Mike?
Yes, sir. Michael Hiram.
Yep. Go right ahead, Michael.
I sent a hard copy of the Hades and a money order to that address where you're at. I was wondering if anybody has seen it. I understand Linda's in Mexico somewhere.
Yeah, we did get two papers recently with a check for the costs for habeas corpus, you know, as far as the mailing is concerned. And we had been kind of paused on that because for numerous reasons, but really just getting the time to get these habeas corpuses going. Yesterday we had a meeting, and we believe now we're going to get started. We're going to have a special meeting tomorrow with a couple of people involved. Matter of fact, Linda, if you're listening, I don't think I spoke to you about this yet. We're going to be talking with another individual who's going to work with us to try to get these papers going. I'm not sure. I think Linda said she can get maybe 6 or 8 out a week. Maybe she can get more. And, of course, the person who's going to be working to get this into the mail and help this process along should be able to handle those. At least they believe they can. We're going to go through this process. So I think by the end of this week, we're going to start pushing along those cases that we have started on and kind of work towards pushing them to finish, and we'll be taking on some new cases. So your case should be moving forward. Just let Linda know. Or that you've sent a money order to help cover the cost. And again, we don't require anybody to pay anything, but we also need money to make the mailings, and we do a lot of certified papers, and there's a process of numerous mailings that have to go out for each habeas corpus. Of course, there's a petition for the habeas corpus and the habeas corpus that needs to be filed, and then there's the decision and then the default, and then if they don't respond, there's a paper that we send out that's called contempt of court with opportunity to amend. And that's kind of where we're at. We are working with sheriffs. We're talking with sheriffs, shall I say, with many, many sheriffs. Working with them to give them the knowledge and understanding of what they need to do because they don't know what to do. And so we're trying to give them the knowledge so that they're going to go out and start arresting these people. And so I think that's coming very, very close, extremely close, as a matter of fact. But, you know, I can't put my finger on exact timing on when that's going to happen. But it possibly could happen in the next couple of weeks, but it could also take them a couple of more months. The sheriffs have to feel comfortable enough of knowledge to be able to defend themselves, and they also need to collect together and back each other up. They need to understand that they're under assault and that that there is movements within our government to do away with them because they are a potential problem with them for the good people in government for them. So, but I think that's going to happen soon. And so once we go to contempt of court with opportunity to amend, we're going to move to the next step, and that actually is to arrest these people, starting with the judge. But again, you know, it's going to be a little more time before that part happens. But we will start pushing the cases forward. We're also going to be working with the mortgage problems, but we're going to deal with them differently. We're not going to be doing habeas corpus. That was the wrong way to go, only because we got confused with what was going on in the courts, what we thought was happening in the courts, and really wasn't. So there is no due process there at all. The whole thing is a violation of law. That they're doing this in a process called NREM, R-E-M, and that, of course, bypasses due process and goes directly for the property without even giving notice to an individual. And so we're going to deal with that and then work with the sheriffs again to bring them up to the knowledge of what they need to do. No property can be removed by anyone, anywhere. And the states that don't have sheriffs have a big problem with this. They are bypassing it all, but we're going to deal with it. Connecticut particularly, who has the sheriff written into their constitution, had no authority to get rid of the sheriff. But nevertheless, no property can be taken away from anyone except through the sheriff. Even the IRS cannot really take your property, at least not legally, without due process of law. And the sheriff needs to be notified of that due process and the intention of the IRS to take your property or whatever. And the IRS usually works and uses the sheriff unknowingly, often in the county, to file the papers. And they may not use the sheriff for the actual seizing of property. Sometimes they will and sometimes they won't. But the whole thing is ignorance. These sheriffs that do respond in ignorance. Now it's time to educate them and bring them out of their ignorance and into knowledge. And it's their duty, and we're going to be straight with them. You guys need to figure this out and work out and keep your oath, so you need to resign your office and let someone come in there that's going to do the job to protect we the people. The sheriff is the unalienable right of we the people. We have an unalienable right to have someone that's a protector of our Constitution. And that's what the sheriff is all about, to make sure due process is taking place. Okay, but anyway, I would say contact Linda. You should have her number, I'm sure, if you've been this far ahead with all your paperwork. Contact Linda, I would say, next week to see where you're at and what's going on. I think what we're going to do, if all goes well in tomorrow's meeting and we get this process going, it'll take a few days for training. Once that happens, maybe by the end of the week, we'll start some of this. And then I think by next week, we'll be moving full gear to catch up with what workload we have and then continue with whatever workload comes in. But we'll just be moving forward.
Is there anything I can do to help? I'll forward more funds. That's what I'll do. I really appreciate it. God bless you all.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay, let's take next caller. Let's see. Is 415?
What's up? It's Jeremiah, 415. Yes. Jeremiah Donaldson, how you doing?
Good. Go right ahead.
Good. My question is for your guest and for anyone else. How does the UCC... how can we use the UCC to tie these agency executives or, agency employees? How can we use the UCC to really tie them down to, this is an open forum right now, right, section of the show?
Well, yeah, this is the open forum. Brent is done, but I'll answer that question. We're ready.
All right, so thank you. But the actual... the thing is I'm sure you probably already have an answer, but considering the fact that the UCC is for agencies and is basically for, it's not for private people, how do you, because I have two questions really. One's about the UCC, how can we use that to nail these dummies? The other one is, how many people on this call are United States citizens? And because... you know, the Constitution
let me finish.
The Constitution protects against the government. In other words, it protects private rights against the government, you know, from the government, like, action, not other private action. So, you know, my issue is that a lot of people on this call are probably U.S. citizens, right, United States citizens, and they want to, make a claim that they're part of a common law, you know, a United States citizenship grand jury, but they're at the same time state citizens. And I don't think a lot of people really understand that. I could be just underestimating people on the call, but my question, I guess, is first about the UCC, and then second, how, are you a U.S. citizen? Go ahead.
Okay, thanks for the question. Yeah, what you're talking about is fiction of law, and they have taken our courts, and really we're under chancery is what they're really doing. They're operating under the rules of chancery. They actually say this in the Judiciary Act of 1789, but I think Marbury versus Madison deals with that and talks about anything that is contrary to the Constitution is null and void. So if it's repugnant, it's null and void. And all this stuff with the fiction of law and playing along with the UCC and the change of language and the meaning of words is all fraud. It's illegal. It is unconstitutional.
Sorry,
it is a fraud against. Excuse me.
It's a fraud against
we the people. I'll mute you for a second, and I'll unmute you when I'm done. It's a fraud against we the people. And we don't advocate for people to have to say go through some kind of an exercise as if they're going to listen to that exercise anyway. A lot of people who do the exercise, maybe 20, 30 years ago, they didn't know what to do. But when they figured it out, then they created a plan to deal with that. And they started to teach the judges what to do with these people. There was a case down in Florida that we were somewhat involved with. As a matter of fact, these people came from us, but they went a different way, and they went to the man on the land business. And we told them not to do this. We told them, don't play that game. You're going to burn yourself. But they wanted to do what they wanted to do, and they played the game, and they went into the court, and the individual was sitting in the courtroom, and they called the person to come up to the bench. He refused. The person at first didn't respond, and then finally did respond and said, here I am, I'm over here. But he refused to go to the forward part of the courthouse. Well, the judge called him again, called him three times, and then put out a warrant for his arrest, right there, a bench warrant. And the officer of the court, right there in the court, went right down and handcuffed him right there in court and took him away, and he spent about a month in jail before he was able to get out. Now, I'm not sure exactly where that case is at this point in time. We have offered our assistance numerous times to do it the right way and to get this guy out of this trouble, and we think we might be able to help him. But again, it's an uphill battle with all this stuff. Anybody going into the court playing the man on the land and trying to say the special magic language that they think they're going to listen to, if you use the UCC processes and you go about doing all these different liens without due process, because even these people that you're doing liens against deserves due process, you know, if we're not going to give them due process, and we deserve that, maybe we shouldn't get due process. So we can't become them. We have to do it the right way. But there's a lot of people out there doing things similar to what we're doing, but bypassing the due process, putting out liens and monetizing these liens and doing all kinds of different things. And some of these people are going to jail. We know quite a few people, again, that we had to separate ourselves from. We had this problem in Florida. We had this problem in Colorado. We had this problem in a couple other places. And it got to the point we had to separate ourselves from these people. And a lot of these people, or some of these people, actually are in jail right now as we speak. We don't participate with that. We go in there into the courts very clearly, very specifically. We bring truth in. It's that simple. Just tell the story the way it is. And whatever they want to play their games, that's all fraud. Again, we don't teach people that they need to get rid of their licenses, they got to get rid of their Social Security number, they got to go and put in a paper and make a declaration, they have to get rid of their U.S. citizenship, and do all these other things, which they're sitting there laughing at us anyway when we do these things. It's not going to amount to a hill of beans, it's not going to protect you, and they're going to put you in jail anyway. You're better off sticking to the truth and laying it out. They'll fear the truth being put in a place where other people can see it. That's what gets to these people. Just keep putting the truth out there and put it. That's why when we file our papers, we don't file it in one federal district court. We file in all 94 federal district courts. They can't expunge our paperwork. And we also send out copies to the sheriffs, to the marshals, the FBI, and numerous other people, Congress, everyone. We send it out to thousands of people every time we file papers. It goes out to everybody. We use the fax to do that particularly. We have 8 fax lines that when we run these papers, they're running 24/7 until they all go out. But am I a United States citizen? Well, look, it was given to the federal government to get a you know, to deal with the citizenship, people coming in. Yeah, you're a United States citizen. I'm a United States citizen. I was natural born. But the point is I'm really a citizen of New York, okay? Or I'm one of the people, which is a better word to use, the common law, and that's the language I use in a courtroom, is one of the people. It's the most powerful position to be in. And but nevertheless, I am a citizen. Our founding fathers used that language. They just took it and made it something evil, something bad, something that they can beat up on, and they play their fictional game in order to define you as something else and really bring you into a corporation. We're familiar with the U.S. Code 26 and all that has happened, and even in 26 it says that the U.S. 26 is not even law, but they won't even listen to that, you know, but we've made that argument before. And so they're lawless. They're not going to listen to anything. So all the magic words people can do is not going to help. But the truth is, of course, is going to set you free. The truth is the best way to deal with this, and they don't like the truth on paper that they can't, you know, expunge. They try to delete it as quick as possible. They don't like that. So that's what we do. But anyway, being a U.S. citizen really means, ultimately, that tomorrow morning, literally, I can roll out of bed and pack a bag and drive across the line from New York to New Jersey or to Pennsylvania. Go rent a place and say I'm from Jersey and I got all the rights and everything necessary that to live as a Jerseyan, a New Jerseyan, and that's what it means. I can go to Florida tomorrow or California. Or I can just visit. I have all my rights. It follows along with me. We're one nation. We're a unit union, and that's what it's all about. But yeah, we don't. Subscribe to the language. We're not going to respond to them. We're not going to give them credibility. We're not going to acknowledge their right to make changes of meanings of words. We just ignore it and go forward. And we have a lot more success that way than going around playing the man on the land game. And so I suggest to look at it from a different perspective. But anyway, I'm going to open your mic back up if you want to respond.
All right. Yeah. Well, I wasn't really implying that man on the land argument by mentioning UCC, so let's just to clear that up. My only thing was that I think that UCC was for them. When I say them, I'm talking about them, the youth. Okay, it's not for private men, but the UCC can be used by us in our claims against them to hammer them, because this is a code that they are bound by. And I want everyone listening to pay attention to that, because we need to understand who we are and what the regulations they are bound by are, so that way when we make our claims, we have some reasonable thought process to be, you know, reckoned with.
Yeah, well, the question becomes, do you want to win or do you want to fight? And, you know, you can go in and you can fight and argue and all this stuff, but if you want to win, you take it down to the basics. And the basic takes us to jurisdiction, due process. That's where it takes us. If they don't have jurisdiction, there's no reason to be where you're at, and they need to exist.
But there are people, John, you have such a great mind, and, like, I do honor what you're doing. There are people that don't want to subscribe to citizenship, and they still want to live as free people without having to subscribe to United States citizenship. How can they take advantage of this common law grand jury thing and still be state citizens at the same time, and without the whole inclusion? Because do you believe in nullification?
Of course I do, but what you're doing is, I think these people are really confused and running away from something that's chasing them that really isn't chasing them. It's a matter of standing on principles and calling the fraud the fraud. Look, when you step up and bring the truth right out, God will bless that to begin with, but you're going to bring the truth right out, and you're not going to argue the point. You're going to call the fraud for what it is. It's a fraud. And once you begin with fraud, everything is a fraud. And this shakes them up. It depends on how well you can hold your grounds on this and your response to them. And look, you can't give them a moment's break at all. When they move one way, you got to give them a writ of error. And you got to go forward, move to the next step, and push it along. And if you don't do that, they look to see. They often they'll do something, and then they'll wait a long time before they do something else.
What's the statutory equivalent to the writ of error, though? Because that's a common law thing. But in the statutes, if you're in one of the adjudications or administrative proceedings, it's going to be pretty difficult to do any type of common law writ or get any type of judicial review unless you exhaust it.
All statutes usually have a time limitation. So it's called the statutory limitation statute. And common law, there is no limitation. If you're injured and you discover 10 years from now you're injured, the case is going to be old and it's going to be hard to prove, but if you can bring up the evidence and you can get the witnesses or whatever is necessary to win the case, you can bring it. For every injury, there must be a remedy. That's a common law principle. It's a maxim of law. So, I would not use, per se, statutes to win a case. I go directly to Constitution. You go to jurisdiction.
Okay. And you use case law?
Here's the bottom line. Everything that, right. Yeah, we do use that too to back us up as far as the United States Supreme Court rulings are concerned. There's a lot of great rulings there. I would never use federal district rulings. Often that's used by a lot of people. I just wouldn't go there. Look, you can use the Constitution and beat most things. And the fact of the matter is all these courts going on right now are courts of fiction. They're de facto courts. They have no authority or jurisdiction over you. And once you lay that out and you start working through the writ of errors and then moving it into the federal court for violation, you write a due process, hijacking you into, and you could bring up the U.S. Codes 42 and 18, hijacking you into a foreign court and so on and so forth, under the color of law. You know, you could bring all those positions up and use the United States law that they've been given the authority to make. Okay, remember, they do have the authority to make certain laws, and you go into Article 1 to discover what the legislators can do. And a lot of this U.S. 18, and particularly the ones I'm talking about in 42, where it talks about being, hijacked off of the roadway or whatever language they use, I forget. But
okay.
In the event to be kidnapped, they actually use the word kidnapping. Mm-hmm. Look, all that was written for us for the sole purpose to be able to go out after these people and get them. Because that's what they're doing. They're kidnapping us off of the highway, and so to speak, and all under the color of law. They have no authority to do this. Any statute that controls your behavior is not a law. Statutes are not meant to control us. Statutes are meant to control them, and that's the power and authority we gave them in Article 1.
Okay. In closing, I'm going to be gone. I'm going to let other callers ask their questions, but I just want to say that the statutes, first of all, the United States Code, including the USCS, which is the United States Code Service, which is the company that is responsible for the codification of the statutes at large, right? See, because the USCA is not actually the finished version of the statutes at large. It's the USCS provided by the United States Code Service that actually finishes it up. But what I was going to say was that is simply prima facie evidence of law. Most people on this call already know that. But the only reason that could – Rod Class – and this is the end of my thing here. But Rod Class said that in Volume 43 of the Statutes at Large, that at the end of it, it ends at March 4th. And he also said that if you look at Volume 44 at the beginning of it, that it begins at December 16th, right? And then if you go to the second book of Volume 44, that it starts at December 7th. Well, he made a mistake. So that doesn't prove, because it's the other way around. December 7th comes in Book 1 of Volume 44. December 16th comes in Book 2. I did the research myself. I took the pictures. It's on my website. But the point I'm trying to make is that the United States Code is simply prima facie evidence of law because it's just a rewrite of the statutes at large for ease of use. So anybody looking to hold a claim in the court should be referring to the statutes at large at all times or to the USCS and not to the USCA. So if you have paperwork, then USCS would be more congressional than the USCA because there's a chance that something might not have been, passed by or codified yet. Or, it could be private law, too. Anyway,
Well,
that's all.
Again, you know, if you have a contract problem and you go into court, you know, there are certain procedures and processes, and you can use the equity court, which is a problem, of course, because these people don't operate under the common law, which they should be, and really.
Yes, they do.
Under
I disagree. I disagree. I'm sorry. I just want to disagree with you. I know, but I want to disagree with you and let you know.
Hold on. I'll let you talk some more after I'm finished, okay? But look, they do whatever they want. It's unfortunate that they don't follow American jurisprudence. Judges don't really have the authority to make judgment in the way that they do. They can't make the law up. They can't interpret the law. It's already interpreted for them. And the law is clear, ultimately. And whenever I go into court, I'm always amazed by the rulings of the judge. I mean, isn't he listening to what's going on? It's become so obvious that he's just working for the corporation. It's just so obvious. But people don't sit in court long enough to know. They're in there for their own case. They're emotionally involved. They don't know what's going on. They don't know the process and procedures often. They may or may not have a lawyer. A lot of people go in there trying to do things without a lawyer, but they haven't studied and prepared themselves to do it, and it's a problem. And I know, because I've been in the courts long before I understood what was how things worked, and trying to, you know, work my way through. And only once did I get a judge that was really pretty decent guy that understood that I didn't really know what I was doing. But he saw what was going on. Matter of fact, he pulled me into the back. He said, "Let's go in my chambers. We're going to talk." And he took us out of the room, and we sat down at this table. The lawyer sat on the one side, I sat on the other side, and the judge sat in the middle. And he just sat down for a moment. He says, "Well, I'm not gonna go through this a second time." And he pointed at the lawyer on the other side. He says, "I want you to make this thing work and do what's right." And he got up and he walked out, and some other guy walked in and negotiated a deal. We hammered out a deal. We walked out, and he ruled on it, and everything worked right. That was such a rarity. It never happened to me before, and it never happened again since. That was a guy who just seemed to be a decent guy trying to do the right thing, and it's rare to find, very rare. But that was an equity court. I was doing the suing. Someone owed me money, and they owed me money. I wanted to get it, and I did get it. I had to negotiate a little down, but I'm good with that. It ended the whole thing. I didn't have to pay for lawyers and so on. But look, equity courts can work. Unfortunately, even there's too much corruption going on. If I'm in a court and it's a criminal court and I'm facing potential prison or loss of my property or some situation like that, could be the IRS or whatever the case may be, I want out of that court. They don't have the authority over me. And so I'm going to challenge their jurisdiction. And I'm not going to let them decide jurisdiction. I'm going to tell them they ain't got it. You ain't got it. I'm going to define how it is. And just the fact that we're sitting here talking and that we're going through a process and you got me before the court and you're trying to make summary judgments here, that proves the fact that we're not in a common law court. We don't belong here. And I'll give him, he could do whatever he wants after that. I just object to everything and then go home, write my papers, give him a writ of error, and move to the next step. I'll remove him from the bench for my case because he's violated my due process. I'm going to sue him for that. And if he doesn't back off after my writ of error, he's got to recuse himself. He's already violated things. And if he doesn't acknowledge that, that's when the lawsuit, and that will remove him from the case. Usually at that point, when you start to move there, we've experienced in most cases, they just kind of, the case falls apart, they let it go, they throw it out, they dismiss it, they don't call you back, whatever, all kinds of stupid stuff. But because they just don't know how to deal with you. And they don't want to get it into a bigger mess because they're now at risk. And so, you know, if I walk away and I don't pursue the lawsuit, you know, they're happy. I'm happy just to get out of their courts. So it's a deal. You know, that's how I look at it anyway. But let me unmute you again, and you can.
Thank you. Thank you for unmuting me. And basically, from what you said, I gather this, that the plaintiff actually has to declare the law of the case, and that's what the judge will determine is the law of the case. I read this information in a first-year legal writing and analysis textbook, okay? That the judge actually.
Are you talking about an equity case or a criminal case?
Any case.
Okay.
Any
so
case.
We're thinking about a criminal case. Mm-hmm. But go right ahead then.
That's fine. But the plaintiff itself actually declares the jurisdiction, not the judge. So a lot of time people going in asking the judge to declare the jurisdiction will not be fruitful, because it's not the judge's job to determine it. People should know to look to the paperwork and ask the prosecutor what the jurisdiction is. Because so that's why it's also important for everyone to try and become the plaintiff in their case by counterclaiming.
Well, jurisdiction defines the law, okay? But I disagree 100% with that, because here in this country, Article 6, Clause 2, this Constitution and the laws of the United States that shall be made pursuant thereof, and all the treaties made which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. When I walk into a courtroom, I'm expecting a common law court, even though they have equity court. And I think America may be the first time in history where an equity court is put under the rules of the common law. Even though they do give, there's no grand jury, there's no trial jury. You know, forget the grand jury, because equity is usually contract and disagreements. But there's no jury there. You're going to go into it without a jury, or you can request a jury if it's over a certain amount. But you're going in there, and there's no jury, and you're accepting that one single jurist to make a decision, and you're accepting that, you're agreeing to that. That's an equity court. But if at the end you don't like what he said, you can appeal it. You go through two processes into the appellate court, and then you can even move yourself up into the federal court, possibly, if there is a constitutional violation. And usually, often you can find one if they've just defrauded you. That in itself, you can turn that into a constitutional issue and put a claim on one of your unalienable rights. But the bottom line, though, is that they must rule under American jurisprudence. They don't have the freedom to make it up off the cuff. They don't have that liberty, and they have to do it honestly. Unfortunately, it's not there in the equity courts. But going back into the criminal courts specifically, let's deal with this for the criminal courts. I'm expecting common law, because that's the law of the land. I don't have to name. I know Bill Thornton teaches this, and I followed along with Bill Thornton. We use a lot of his stuff. He's got a lot of great points. This is one place where I come into differences with him. He also looks at the king of the court as being you. I'm not the king of the court. I'm a sovereign in the court, and I'm looking for the king to give me justice.
Well, what do you mean criminal court?
The king of my court is God, principles of God.
What do you mean criminal court, though? When you say criminal court, what do you mean?
Well, maybe I shouldn't use the word criminal, but if it's a criminal, I guess you can call it whatever you want to call it. But if they're coming after you, and you're going to be in a situation where maybe the IRS is coming after you, they'll call it a crime, or maybe some other thing. Maybe it's driving without a license or something, and you're facing
right.
a potential jail.
That's not it's not a crime.
Well, no, it's not. Yeah, but it's not a criminal court. It's a.
But under their statutes, it's a crime, right?
It doesn't matter. That's why I'm going to tell them they don't have jurisdiction. I'm going to get due process here. Take me into my own court. Take me into the court of common law.
Okay, good point, because it doesn't matter if it's criminal or civil. If they just don't have jurisdiction, they just don't.
And they don't have
period.
The authority to do it and operate what they're doing. When the people get into the court, it's going to become clear to the town courts, the village courts, they're all going to go out of business. And if the courts go out of business, they're not going to be able to make money, so a lot of the police forces will go out of business. And then we'll get down to the real law. We'll get the sheriff out there, because he's the one that should take over and take up this, or whatever is necessary. But look, they create crimes. They make everybody's a criminal. You're guilty of a whole bunch of things. We just got to watch you for a while. We'll figure out what you're guilty of, and we'll put you in jail. They can do that to anybody, almost. Okay? So they watch you, and they figure out what it is you can be guilty of and what they can get you on, because everybody's a criminal. And that's another way they're trying to move towards, preventing people from having weapons. That's another form of gun control. Give them a racket, make them guilty of something, call them a felon, and now they can never get a gun for life. I know someone who's in their 70s and can't get a permit to get a weapon, and yet they had a problem when they were very, very young, before they hit 20, they had a situation.
Yeah, but that only applies to U.S. citizens, not state citizens.
No, it applies, and you can't make the magic word and think it's going to go away. It's not going to happen. You may think.
What are you talking about, magic words? I don't know what that means.
Well, just what I said, look at you, if you go into their court and all of a sudden they realize you're using the right language, you're putting them into their box, they ignore all that. There was a time there was a time when nobody knew about this stuff, and people that were finding out and they were using it, and they were getting a little wins in the court because they frightened the judge or whatever. But what they did is then they started to pick up on that, and then they would teach a defense for the judge to use to deal with you. And often they'll get you in contempt of court. They'll say, "Hey, shut up! Don't talk about those things here. We're not here. Whatever." They'll do anything they want, and then they'll put you and they'll put the fear of jail into you. Okay, there's all kinds of things that they do, and I've seen it all the time. And if you don't, if you go into family court, they're going to take your children away if you don't conform and do what has to be done. They're going to take you, if you're a father, every father is a criminal. You see them come in with handcuffs on, they've got a criminal record now, and they deny their access to their children, and they just go on and on and on. They abuse people all over the place, and they get away with it. And they're not going to acknowledge you with the language. They're getting more hardcore. You know, when the constitutional man, I'm trying to think of his name, when the constitutional man was...
Carl Miller.
He was teaching what he was teaching. He was having some success. He also was teaching from jail, too. Remember, he got to jail. But look, he had some success back in the 90s. The Carl Miller stuff, a lot of that doesn't work anymore. That much, because they found a way around it. They made a plan, and now they deal with you in a different way. And when something new comes up, they'll try to figure out how to deal with you. But you know what they have a real big problem with? Is just coming to the straight-out, all-out truth. Just come to the truth. Call the fraud. Let them know they're de jure, I mean, they're de facto, and that you need to be moved into the proper court. And in that proper court, they can't take no action against you because they have there's no injured party.
Oh,
So, anyway, we should move on to the next caller, and we can talk again in another time. Okay? All right, thanks. I don't know if he dropped away or what, but let's go to our next caller. It looks like it's Brad again. How you doing, Brad? Go right ahead. You got the mic. And by the way, anybody wants to get into the queue, *6 to get into the queue. *6. Go ahead, Brad.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it. That gentleman, he is onto something. It is contract law. That's where they've changed their strategy, so to speak. With the UCC, their codes and their statutes and all of that, where they get you is they trick you in the jurisdiction. And you just have to know your words. You know, when you're writing your papers, words have meanings. You know, Black's Law Dictionary is there for a reason. And your word today, they just like they did with citizen, okay? They spun it around and, you know, made it mean something that it truly wasn't intended to mean. And that's how they trick people. And the fact that people now are learning this, we didn't have the internet in the 90s. You know, when Carl Miller was doing that work, you know, the internet was just blossoming, I guess, or starting. There are more people that are informed today or becoming informed and educated. And, you know, we're not dumb. Right? We created the government. So, therefore, you know, we are not stupid. We just didn't have that stream of information to educate ourselves. But you're right. They will take your kids. They will do it. They're going to do that regardless, John.
You got to be real good at it. You got to be real good to be able to fight.
You
got to
be real good. You're
right. And it's difficult, and it's very rare. In these days, too rare to win or going into their sandbox.
You're exactly right, John. And if you try taking them on, see, the beauty of this organization is, okay, is everybody is being taught, okay? All right, well, they're going to, if they take me out and they lock me up, like they locked this Pete Santelli up, I mean, the stuff that's going on in Oregon right now, okay, they have literally locked those people up. They have limited access to their lawyer. They have no, you know, the attorney-client privilege thing there, that's gone. Right now, they can't even get a phone call to their lawyer without it being monitored. So, I mean, they're going to trample us as a people until...
Well, that's true. It's all on a lockdown, and they really want to know everything that's going on and everything that the other side knows, because they did murder that guy. There's no doubt about it.
There's no doubt about it.
And they need to get as much intel as they can to know how to defend themselves.
Right.
So, but go ahead.
And that's been going on for how long, John? It's just mm-hmm. that people that are waking up, they're turning off the TV, realizing that it's nothing but propaganda, and they're looking for a different source, and they're getting the truth. You cannot do this alone, though. You have to be a group. You have to be a body. You know, the body of Christ, the bride of Christ. You know, you take one person out, there's 15 more standing in place, okay? I mean, that's the beauty of this organization, okay? You cannot do this alone. I know there's people out here that are very intelligent, and they think they know it, and you may know it, but you cannot do this alone because they'll take you out. Don't think they won't. They're doing it now. Look at those people in Oregon. It's sad. I mean, if you're not praying for those people, they are truly patriots that have stood up, you know, for our liberties. And if we're not supporting them, and whether we're just watching them or letting them know, that guy's locked up. He's on lockdown 23 hours a day. Tell me that's not going to weigh on me.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that I went into Q, John, was this. I was in this, an hour of this, I was on the Skype, okay? Did you say anything about the updates as far as what's going on? I know for the past 2 weeks you've been saying there's something that's exciting that's coming our way, and I was hoping that I didn't miss it, and I was hoping you had something.
Yeah, we remember, I'll tell you a little hint on this. Oregon is ground zero for really the battle in liberty, and there is a... But I'm got. Can you mute your mic? I mean, mute your speakers because we're getting feedback. Can you mute that side? Okay. And but Oregon is ground zero. There's a lot I'd like to share that I'm not at liberty to share. I'm not sure what I can say and what I can't say yet. But there is a lot of I'll say marriages going on at this point of compatibility, and that's the key, compatibility. We have principles, and if these when we connect with people or groups of people. You know, they need to understand what our principles are, and they need to be able to adhere to them. If they can't, it doesn't matter how much we think that we're going to be able to use them as a leverage, not only for we the people to get back our nation, we're not going to connect because we'll never be blessed for that. So we have to. There has to be compatibility, principled-wise. Also, there has to be an appreciation for what we're doing and a realization they need to educate themselves a little bit in what we're doing, although they need to be working on their own, whatever it is that they want to work on, and we can work together. And that's what we're doing. And I don't want to – I can – there's numerous groups, and sheriffs are part of that. And right now, again – I don't know really know how much I can speak about it. I'm not really down in the nuts and bolts of things on a lot of this stuff. Gerard's handling most of this on that end, and there's a lot of negotiations going on. We have a national leadership. We have people who are communicating with individuals and working things out, and again just bringing things together. And we haven't been able to get a good picture and agree that we can start saying what it is that we're doing. Also, to some degree, it's an advantageous for us to maybe be silent on some things for a while. But it's going to break soon, and it's just a lot of really super exciting things going on. The pressure is up. I can tell you right now, they are on the run in Oregon. And not just in Oregon, all the way down there into Nevada, because the two cases are connected up with the Bundys and the Hammonds. We're intimately involved in both of those cases. And there are things we're doing that we'll be talking about soon in those cases. But I can tell you that this was an assassination, and there are people that we know who they are, and they're gonna be held accountable, and we're gonna go after some big people. But again, you know, where we're going with this and how we're doing it and who's involved, I'm not at privilege to speak. But eventually it'll be known. There are news people involved with us too now, and that'll come out soon. Nothing really big, but big enough in certain areas where it counts, and then you know the other news medias will be picking up off of them. So it's not just alternative news, although we do have alternative news with us on many levels. So a lot of exciting things going. So But that's about it. That's all I can say.
That's a beautiful thing, John. I appreciate the update. And I'm glad that you're keeping this close to your chest, because they are listening. You said, they're running. So, but it's nice just to get a little primer of what's going on there. And it sounds like you're doing what needs to be done by bringing more people and getting more people involved and making sure that they are lined up, you know, with their hearts, so to speak. You know, as a whole, the American people are good people. I mean, you know, God-fearing people, or if you don't believe in God, whatever. We are generally good people. And by you not spilling the beans, it's not, you know, equipping our enemy with that information so that they can change their tactics. But
Let me ask you a question. I had to change my mic when you were talking. Am I coming through clear or broken up or what?
No, you're clear. You're a little muffled, but I can understand you, no problem.
Okay, well, am I as good as I was before? Because my other mic is better.
I would say so.
All right. I'm going to try to continue with this mic. Hopefully it'll be okay to get us through the last 15 minutes or so, because it takes me a few minutes to get my other wireless going, and Gerard's not here to keep things up while I do that.
But
so.
There is encouragement in the UCC. There is remedy in the UCC. And what that gentleman was leading to is using their weapon against them. For every law that they put in place, or statute or code that they put in place, they also put a remedy in there. But they bury it, and they move it around. Like somebody put in a chat here, UCC 208-1. That code, that remedy, has now been moved. It is now UCC 308, or excuse me, UCC 308-1. And if you write in your paper and you refer to that to that UCC 208-1, it might have a very different meaning than what you were intending to, you know, have in your paper for the remedy. So that's just another sleight of hand that they use.
I agree with you on this. To some degree, you can play, but you're playing this sandbox.
Well, you're playing with fire. You better know what you're doing. And you better not be alone.
And that's the other side of this thing. Because, if you are alone, they'll take opportunity of finding you in contempt for something and putting you in a jail for a while to sit and then they'll pull you back out eventually, like they did with many. Look at, they'll put the pressure on you. And they got to cover their crimes up. They're going to cover their crimes up. And they all.
This is trillions of dollars we're talking about here. This isn't small potatoes. They will kill you, plain and simple. They don't kill you. They will put you away, whether it's like Guantanamo Bay, someplace else in one of their dark sites. Do not think for a second that you, as an individual, can come against this tyrannical beast. You know, that is the devil. Make no mistake about it. And he will deal with you the way he sees fit. But as a people, as a group, as the God-fearing, God-loving people that we are here with our Judeo-Christian beliefs that this country was founded upon, Satan is a defeated foe. He's just divided us. And it's time for us to come together. And don't do this by yourself, because you will lose, and you will lose big. It will cost your family generations. So, you know, the other thing I wanted to say is that New Hampshire division of the NLA, with their YouTube show, and those guys are doing a broadcast on the PBS, I guess it is. That is so awesome. I've watched every episode that they've done.
I'm not familiar with that. Maybe you can send me information on that.
Really? They have a YouTube channel. Honest to God, you don't know about that.
Nope, not at all.
Oh boy, yeah, you got to check that out. Just
you can send something to Gerard at nationallibertyalliance.org, and also to me. I just got a lot of email right now, and I got about 800 some odd emails.
But those boys in New Hampshire do a weekly broadcast, and they're exposing what's going on here. It's news, you know. Let me see.
Well, send me a link to that.
Okay, I certainly will. I'm going to put it in the chat if you don't mind.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay.
Okay, then.
All right, let's take our next caller. Appreciate it. Let's see. Is that Stephanie?
the next caller. STEPH, is that Stephanie or Stephen? You've been unmuted.
That is Curtis and Stephanie from South Dakota.
How you doing?
Hey, God bless you guys. Say, just wanted to bring up David Barton wrote what was called the original intent, and Lavoie Finicum he teaches that on his website as well. And basically, it's all of the court cases throughout history that go back to the original intent. So what David Barton said, it was our Constitution operates on a longstanding principle, which were recognized and incorporated in our government over 200 years ago. Each constitutional provision reflects a specific philosophy implemented to avoid a specific problem. Therefore, grasping the purpose of any clause of the Constitution is possible only through a proper historical understanding of the debates and the conclusions reached 200 years ago. For example, when adjusting the permissible in the realm of public religious expressions, courts revert to what they perceive to be the intent of those who in 1789 drafted the religion clauses of the Constitution. Likewise, the perception of historical intent similarly affects the debates on gun control, Second Amendment, states' rights, 10th Amendment, abortion, and the 9th and 14th Amendments, flag burning, First Amendment, etc. Therefore, if our understanding of historical facts and constitutional intent becomes confused or mistaken, the resulting policies may be not only ill-founded, but actually create the very abuses that the founders originally intended to avoid. And, you know, I was in direct response to Carl, who is studying these things on the IRA, and I think if he studies this, and Curtis and I were down and took the Constitution course in down in Philadelphia with Rick Green, who's a friend of David Barton's. And, you know, so we studied the Founding Fathers and the original intent. And, you know, it just it has a lot of a wisdom in that.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, look at the Constitution. It is true. You go back to the original debate concerning the Constitution. We've got the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, lots of letters written back and forth between some of our founding fathers. And the conclusion, of course, is that this small little handbook that we have that we can stick in our top shirt pocket, and it is extremely powerful. And I could tell you, you know, look, when I first read through this the first few times, I found a little difficulty in but then, you know, once you start to put some of these things into perspective and you're starting to understand what it is you're really looking for and what powers does the government really have, once you start to think in those terms and to see how it is that they framed it out and how that the Constitution is governed by the Bill of Rights. And again, the Bill of Rights is the key, in my opinion, to really chaining down our servants by the Constitution and interpreting this. There's anything in this Constitution that they think that they can take to a place where it violates one of our unalienable rights, and then now it becomes a problem and is null and void. But it is clear, look at the powers that we've given our government is very, very minimum. You know, I believe it's 18 powers for legislature, and we defined what law we're under for the judiciary, and we defined the courts and what they're to operate under, and they're supposed to be obedient to the supreme law of the land, and even the executive, the minimum amount of power that we've given the executive. But the two keys, in my opinion, to the Constitution, and actually there are three, the foundation for the Constitution was the Declaration of Independence, which squarely put us into common law. You cannot deny it. It talks about the unalienable rights, and it talks about the Creator and our right to be equal, that all men are equal. When you get into the Constitution, you know, you have the preamble, which sets the mode for government and what the government is here to do. And I believe that it numbers out to six specific things. Every action that government does has to fulfill one of these six specific things that is laid out here in the preamble. And let me read that. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, okay? So anything government has to do has to be working towards forming that more perfect union. And that more perfect union really is the union of the states to be as one, to be United States citizens, for instance. I'm a United States citizen. Ultimately, what it means for me, is the fact that I'm a citizen of every state. I can travel and become that citizen as I move through the states. And I, you know, I don't need a passport, and I understand the people. On a basic ground. I mean, people have different backgrounds and, you know, there's all kinds of different things that people have from different states and just different areas that we live in geographically. But basically, we share the same law. It's a common law. And we know we have the same unalienable rights. We understand each other on that level. But anyway, to form a more perfect union. So whatever they're doing, is it forming a more perfect union? Establish justice. Is it establishing justice? It has to fulfill one of these 6 points. Ensure domestic tranquility is what they're doing and writing and what legislating they're putting out or whatever the president may think he could do. Is it bringing domestic tranquility? Is it providing for the common defense? Or do they provide for the general welfare? And is it securing the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity? That's the questions. 6 points. And if they can't fulfill one of those 6 points, they shouldn't be doing anything. And of course, we've restricted them very specifically. If you're in Article 1, you know, we got into the very specific powers that government has. And we find that in Section 8, the Congress shall have the power to do certain things. And again, I believe it's 18 things, if I recall the number count. And then as Brent brought up today, then there's Section 9, what they can't do to make sure, let's make it clear, you know, you can't take away the privilege of writ of habeas corpus. You can't make a direct tax. The IRS, it's all illegal right here in the Constitution. They can't do it, okay? And yet they are, because the people have become ignorant. And that was by design. They purposely left things out of our education and dumbed us down as from generation to generation until we're here. They've turned us against each other. They've turned us against God. They demoralized us. They're demoralizing our children. Our children are spoiled, and the schools are just feeding into that. They're teaching them to live in militarized zones. They go through, these scanners, the X-ray scanners or whatever, looking for metals. And it's just ridiculous, ridiculous. But that's where we're at. But nevertheless, this if we can get back and hold this paper up and hold them to this little booklet, we'll bring everything back under control. But it is true. Where it becomes a little controversial, if they think it's controversial, our founding fathers cleared it up in these debates. I think pretty much so. But a logical argument could be made. You violate one of my unalienable rights, it's null and void, and I don't care what it says. And that is the main principle. So you have the foundation, which is the Declaration of Independence. You have the framework of government, which is the Constitution as we understand it. And then, of course, the addition, which is still part of the Constitution, is the Bill of Rights. That's the capstone. And between the three, it's really a great document and gives us a lot of power and authority if we can use it. And I want to tell you, when we bring these things into the courts, they are just silent because they have no response to. They don't know what clue to do with us. And as they move from one thing to another and we're able to do the next thing and the next thing, again, we just befuddle them. So powerful document. Okay.
Well, and then the other thing is bringing this Committee of Safety and Sheriff Mack with the CSPOA is so awesome because, you know, we had sent over Poco's Blackhorn, had gotten her 8 children stolen. And then Dawn Cullens had her 2 sons, autistic kids, stolen. And we talked to Skylar over at or CSPOA, and he said, just reach out to him. Anything that you have, and if you got the app, well, we send the affidavit and the intake from National Liberty Alliance, and he said that, Skylar said that he was working with National Liberty Alliance as well as getting the, well, we went to, this aside, we went to get a website, because Linda said get a website on get your community to safety. And so we are working on South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, and Wyoming, and we'd like some direction of how you would
And
like
we're going to be given, before anybody does anything in that area, we suggest they wait until Saturday because we're going to talk on specifics of those things. The Committee of Safety is really, look, it's something that, came up in Oregon. I'm not sure exactly how that was brought out to Oregon, but it's something that has really assisted them. It has helped to make a connection between us and them. And they're seeing and understanding the common law through it because it's a common law creation to begin with. And really, you know, the Committee of Safety comes together because of an emergency within a community. And guess what? There's an emergency in every community. So that's what takes it to the nation side of things. And this is something, you know, if anybody's battling against certain things, whether they're going up against the gun control, whether they're going up against the Agenda 21, it doesn't matter what you're going up against. The Committee of Safety is the solution to this. It's where people in the community come together, discuss the problems, and try to figure out what it is we're going to do, and then start using the necessary, the available tools to fix and create this problem, even as far as being able to call a militia to bring in law and order. They can do that. They bypass the sheriff and everything. That potential is there. I'm not sure how that all works, and because I'm still haven't learned it yet myself. I just heard little things, and so I could be an error in something I'm saying here, so I want to be careful. You know, nevertheless, the fact that they're looking to solve the problems, okay, that is the key thing. And you know what? The people in the liberty groups that are working towards liberty and trying to fix these problems and see the problems, and maybe they don't understand what's going on in the court, so they don't get involved with us because they think it's beyond them when it really isn't. We're all about the Constitution. But they don't know yet. But, you know, they'll have access to us through the Committees of Safety because that they understand, they're going to get that real quick. But we take the Committee of Safety down into the grassroots, the real grassroots. We go into these liberty groups, and we need to, and this is what we're going to be teaching. We need to do this nationwide in every state, in every county, in every town. Let's go into the liberty groups. Let's deliver to them the Committee of Safety. Get them on board to go take a look to see how things work. Come to some of the meetings. Get some meetings going. Start on a county level and then work down into the town developments. You know, we're going to talk about this on Saturday at noontime, and we're going to be using the other room. We'll be changing the information to get into the other room back on our Monday night program. So that'll be the same room, which will be the high-definition free conference call. And but we're going to switch back to that for a while, and as long as we can get work out over there, we'll stay there because we think the controls, it works a lot better, that program, than what we're on right now. We're paying for what we're on right now. But in any event, we're going to be in that room. It'll be Saturday at noontime. We're going to talk about these things and lay it out. People are going to be able to get to meet the individual who's going to be training us and getting all of the information together. We'll put it up on our website. And this is what's going to help to bring the liberty groups together. Look, at only the people can save the nation. Only the people. And we have to hit critical mass. And this is one of the things. Yeah, we're working out things with the sheriffs. And this, what is it? The CSPOA, I think it's called, if I got the letters right. We're working things out with that. There's a lot of different groups. And I don't want to get into the details because I'm not sure on what I should be saying yet or not. And also we need to be careful on how much we do reveal. But it's all going to be revealed very soon anyway. And people are going to be very excited about this. It should excite them to re-energize those who have fallen back to sleep, hopefully. But it also we need to wake up and bring to people in from the liberty groups, and they don't need to stop doing what they're doing. They should continue doing. We want the Oath Keepers to continue doing what they're doing in the Oath Keepers. Go to their meetings. We want the people in different liberty groups doing whatever they're doing. Continue doing what they're doing, but pay attention to what we're doing and use the tools that we're providing and putting out there. we are going to be the hammer for the committees of safety, because when the committee of safety gets to a certain point and they need to try to do something, well, one of the first steps they can move to is the grand jury. And so we'll be teaching that into the system. And that'll bring a connection to people to look into what we're doing, get a little taste of the law, start to realize it's not all that difficult, and to realize that it's all about the Constitution, and it's a simple booklet, and it's written in plain language. We just have to read through it very carefully, because there's a lot packed into each sentence, that's all. So anyway, that's where we're going with that. Any final comment?
Well, and just wanted to say, like in South Dakota, talked to this gentleman, Wayne, at Citizens Liberty, and he said that as far as Citizens for Liberty, we have to put things that we're giving them, you have to say it's for education, because they are under, the government, so they have to say that they're educational facility. But as far as the oath takers, they can take it. They don't have to go to any board meetings where Citizens for Liberty do. So when you're trying to understand, because I was having a little I was like, why are they not posting this right away? And what it was about, it has to go to the board, it has to say education, and then it's accepted by the government with their group. And Oath Keepers in South Dakota doesn't have that. So all of our urgent messages with this went out to them right away. So just maybe help those folks out there that are trying to get to the liberty groups, and I didn't understand.
Okay, well, you know, hopefully they'll come and connect with us. And again, there are lots of people who are. And maybe they'll be able to get to our meeting on Saturday, and we'll start constructing an understanding of what it is we're trying to do, and people will take it from there, and we'll develop and grow and see where we go. You know, again, this is a people thing. One of the things we want to do is get people to do what has to be done on a grassroots level. And until they're educated in certain areas, you know, we will sort of hold their hands and keep them on the right track, and you know, show them what they have to do, what they need to know, and where they got to go, and eventually they'll figure it out. The problem is we've been dumbed down. Now we got to, you know, get rid of some of this dumbness, so to speak. We got to start educating ourselves and opening our eyes a little bit, our ears and our minds. So. All right, we've come to the end of our night, but we do have one other caller, so I want to try to fit him in, and then we'll close down. Appreciate the call. Thank you. Okay, let's take our last caller, and that
I'm afraid of you. Let's just put it that way.
Go right ahead.
But you are going to attack me, right?
Yeah, because the way you called me, I'm begging for.
I wasn't even talking to you.
Huh?
I wasn't talking to you.
I guess he's busy, so. Okay, we're going to end our program here tonight. Appreciate everyone coming. And remember, as we mentioned, we've got a lot of things going on. We need to get active. We need everyone to get active. Everybody into the battle. On Wednesday, we have a meeting at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, again, for the sole purpose of organizing the nation. We're going to be focusing in at the federal level, federal district level. And then on Saturday at noontime, again, we're going to get together to really start working out and hammering out the details and the plans and preparations for the Committee of Safety. We'll bring some information and conclusions to our next Monday night meeting. And hopefully next Monday night meeting, I believe we've got papers going into the court, long overdue, but we have two papers going into the courts. And we also have a paper that we're doing for the PowerPoint for the sheriffs, giving them some authority and power and laying it out where it comes from, trying to empower them and really get to see that they need to step up and do what has to be done, you know. So, okay, with that, thanks again for everyone coming, and please let's get involved, get into the battle here. Let's do what has to be done.
Nothing's good. You gave the best you had to give. Just